putting yourself into an emotional place, which is pretend, but your body doesn't know the difference.
Desert Island Discs on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday mornings at 10.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on digital radio. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 22nd of May. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Katia Adler.
The headlines today, the man who quit as the Green Party candidate in the Makerfield by-election yesterday has apologised for social media posts that he shared about an attack on Jewish ambulances in London. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Cuba as a threat to America's national security, ramping up pressure on the island's communist government. We'll take you into Cuba at 7:30 and ask, what is Trump's endgame here?
I think Donald Trump has as an endgame the idea that I will liberate Cuba. It's about power.
Also in today's programme, what are the practical realities of implementing the new guidance on single-sex spaces?
Businesses will need time to adapt to make sure that they get this right. And in some small cases, that will mean adaptation of their facilities and they need time to do that.
We'll put that to the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission at 8:10. Is enough being done to tackle the root causes of misogyny? Former Safeguarding Minister Jess Phillips will be with us at 7:50. And with a new novel on the horizon, Hamnet screenwriter Maggie O'Farrell takes us inside her hefty awards cabinet.
This is the BAFTA, and that's the Golden Globe. It's really
heavy. Is it?
Somebody handed it to me on stage, and I really nearly dropped it on Steven Spielberg's foot. Can you imagine?
That would have been a bit awkward. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The Green Party says its former candidate in the Makerfield by-election has apologised for sharing social media posts that described the attack on Jewish ambulances in North London as a false flag. Chris Kennedy withdrew his candidacy yesterday with the party citing personal and family reasons. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
When Chris Kennedy, a registered nurse and children's safeguarding specialist, was unveiled as the Green candidate, the party's leader, Zach Polanski, said he would make a fantastic representative for the area. But just a few hours later, he withdrew from the race. The party still insists that was for personal and family reasons. The Times newspaper reported that Mr. Kennedy had shared social media posts which described an attack on Jewish community ambulances in North London earlier this year as a false flag, a term which usually means staged. A spokesperson said the posts didn't reflect the views of the Green Party. They said they had spoken to Mr. Kennedy about the posts and said he had deleted them and apologised for any offence caused.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Cuba as a threat to US national security and warned that the chances of a peaceful agreement with the Caribbean nation are not high. Washington has been ramping up pressure on the communist government in Havana, including by charging Cuba's former president Raul Castro over the shooting down of two planes in 1996. From Washington, here's our correspondent Joel Gunter.
Trump administration officials have previously alluded to the possibility of military action against Cuba, but Marco Rubio's latest remarks will take on added weight after the murder charges leveled against Raul Castro. Casting doubt on a diplomatic outcome, Mr. Rubio said the Trump administration was both very serious and very focused on changing the Cuban regime. His comments follow a build-up of U.S. military might in the region, with the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier and three escort warships arriving in the Caribbean Sea in recent days. Cuba's foreign minister yesterday denied that the country posed a threat to the U.S., saying the accusation was a pretext for U.S. aggression.
Mr. Rubio has now flown to Sweden for a meeting of NATO foreign ministers. Before he boarded the flight, he said President Trump was very upset with members of the Defence Alliance for going into hiding during the Iran war. It's expected Mr. Rubio will use the gathering to press for burden sharing between Washington's NATO partners. Detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office have repeated their call for people to come forward with information. It's understood detectives are concerned that potential witnesses might think they're focusing only on the allegation that the former prince shared a confidential trade report with Jeffrey Epstein. Here's our UK correspondent, Daniel Sanford.
Thames Valley Police detectives arrested Andrew Mountbatten Windsor in February on suspicion of misconduct in public office. He was released under investigation later that day. The initial allegation arose out of the publicly released Epstein files and concerned the alleged leaking of government reports to Jeffrey Epstein. But detectives are stressing their investigation is examining a number of aspects. Misconduct in public office is a complex offence, which potentially can include a wide range of behaviour, including abusive position, sexual misconduct and corruption. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied wrongdoing in relation to his association with Epstein and has denied any personal gain from his role as a UK trade envoy.
Parents of some of the children injured in the Southport knife attack say they believe they've received insufficient support because of the anonymity given to them by courts. They've told the BBC they feel their daughters' experiences have been erased from the public's understanding of the case. Sefton and Lancashire councils say they're continuing to provide support for those affected. But the mother of one girl who was stabbed 33 times says she feels let down.
We have had responses that have been, well, we didn't know who these girls were and we didn't know where they were, which I don't accept for a moment. I think there is a very wide level of confusion over who is taking responsibility for these children. I think we have fallen through the cracks.
MPs are urging the NHS in England to do more to promote physical activity for older people, saying it can be just as important as medication. The Commons Health and Social Care Committee is recommending that GPs and other health staff should routinely discuss exercise with older patients. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The MPs argue that exercise can be more effective than medication and can help reduce pressure on the NHS. Their recommendations include GPs and other health staff having routine conversations about physical activity with patients, more social prescribing for activities such as swimming, yoga and walking, and ensuring inspections of care homes check on exercise programmes. The Department of Health said it was prioritising prevention and personalised care so people could take part in activities to improve health and well-being.
Lily Allen has received the Outstanding Song Collection Prize at the 71st Ivor Novello Awards in London, which celebrate excellence in songwriting and music composition. Sam Fender won Songwriter of the Year and the Irish singer C-Matt won Album of the Year. Sir Elton John was given a special honour, named the first ever President of the Ivors Academy, a role which will see him advocate for the rights of musical creatives. On stage, Sir Elton applauded what he called the British essence of song. Writing.
Creativity, when you're writing music or writing a song, is probably the greatest thing you can ever have. Music is the greatest gift you can possibly be given. It's an incredible feeling to see all this young talent streaming past. We're an amazing country that produces great songwriters and always has.
Elton John, the new president of the Ivors Academy.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It is just turning 8 minutes past six. Time to say good morning to Simon King, who's got the weather. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Emil. Good morning. It's going to turn very warm over the next few days, even hot. And in fact, by Bank Holiday Monday, it's looking increasingly likely that as temperatures approach 33 degrees Celsius, it could be the hottest May day on record. For today, lots of sunshine across most areas. So let's start off in southwest England and Wales, where there'll be sunshine really from the word go, and that will last well into this evening. The exception will be the far west of Wales and the far west of southwest England, where there will be stubborn clouds and a bit of coastal mist around this morning. There may even be the odd spot of rain around West Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly. So where you've got that cloud in the far west, temperatures will be around about 15 to 17 degrees, but elsewhere we will see those temperatures rise to 21 to 27 Celsius. For the southeast of England, the Midlands and eastern England, lots of sunshine and feeling much warmer compared to yesterday with highs of 25 to 28. It's possible around Cambridgeshire we could see 29 or even 30 degrees. For northwest and northeast England, dry with a good deal of sunshine for most of the day. There will be some cloud at times, more so I think to the far northwest where around the Lake District temperatures will be about 15 to 21, elsewhere 22 to 26 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland and across Scotland, it's mostly cloudy today, and there is some rain, I think, for northern and western areas of Scotland at times. Temperatures will be limited to about 13 to 18 degrees in the far northwest of Scotland. Elsewhere, there could be the odd brighter spell, and temperatures up to about 19 to 22.
Thank you very much, Simon. Are you ready for the heat, Amal?
Ready for the heat? I'm born ready for the heat. Yes, absolutely. I was going to come in shorts, but we've left that to Mike Williams, who will be in shorts very shortly.
Indeed. It's 9 minutes past six.
Let's have a look at the morning paper, shall we? The Daily Telegraph leads on the arrest of five people by Greater Manchester Police following an investigation into suspected fraud in this month's local elections. The ward in question is in the constituency of the former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, the Telegraph says, adding that it understands Miss Rayner says the developments have nothing to do with her and that suggestions that she's involved in wrongdoing are baseless. A Labour spokesperson tells the paper that no evidence has been presented of the party being involved in the allegations.
The Daily Mirror reports that police investigating Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office are assessing claims of sexual offences. A woman allegedly sent by Jeffrey Epstein to the former Prince's Royal Lodge is at the centre of the probe, according to the paper. The Daily Mail says an appeal by Thames Valley Police for fresh information as they continue their misconduct probe is unprecedented. The papers all note that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has consistently and strenuously denied any wrongdoing.
The Times leads on the same story, and it carries a picture from 2015 of the former prince standing with his late mother. In an editorial, the Times says Queen Elizabeth made a bad mistake when she pressed for him to become a UK trade envoy, as was revealed in files released yesterday. The paper recalls a prediction from the Prince of Wales, now the King, that the appointment was a disaster waiting to happen.
The Guardian reports that a bitter row has broken out between the Mayor of London and Scotland Yard after Sir Sadiq Khan blocked a £50 million deal between the Met and the American data firm Palantir. The Mayor is said to have intervened because of concerns about the procurement process.
And expected stock exchange listings by the US tech giants Anthropic, SpaceX and OpenAI are set to create a trading frenzy on Wall Street, according to the Financial Times. The paper says relentless investor appetite for AI could help the trio raise tens of billions of dollars.
It's 11 minutes past six.
Well, let's turn to Cuba. What does the Trump administration want to see happen in Cuba? Is it regime change? Overnight, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said that diplomacy is running out of road when it comes to achieving U.S. foreign policy goals in Cuba. Of course, Rubio has a Cuban heritage. Will Grant is our Mexico, Central America and Cuba correspondent. I spoke to him a short time ago, and I started by asking him why the U.S. interest in Cuba is increasing.
Well, it basically comes down to the fact that the Trump administration feels that they can sort of achieve something that no other administration has been able to achieve when it comes to Cuba, and that is regime change, in essence. Now, whether or not that regime change comes in the form of a complete change in direction or personnel change at the top, it's pretty clear from the things being said by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, by Donald Trump himself, that they see nothing less than wholesale economic or political change as necessary. They're going to force this situation until they get what they want, either via the negotiating table or, as you say, with the specter of military action, because of course it was only in January that we saw the removal of Nicolas Maduro from power in Venezuela through US military action, and in the wake of that the oil was switched off to Cuba, and as you know, the situation has become worse and worse and worse with each passing week.
And the trigger for the most recent sort of, if you like, escalation or surge in interest was this charging of Raul Castro with murder owing to an attack on two planes 30 years ago. But just overnight, Marco Rubio has sort of escalated things further, hasn't he? He's a very busy man at the moment, Marco Rubio, and he seems to be suggesting that diplomacy itself is running out of road.
He does seem to be suggesting that. I mean, he, as a Cuban-American Florida senator, knows the Cuban situation very well. And he's not going to be convinced by small changes from the Cuban government that might be offered. He is seemingly growing impatient and is demanding, as I say, kind of root and branch reform, which the Cuban government doesn't seem to be obviously keen on having dictated to its direction of government by Washington. So there is the fact that He has basically said that there'll be $100 million for humanitarian aid, but it needs to be distributed by the Catholic Church, by aid agencies that operate in Cuba, and cannot be done by the commercial wing of the Cuban military, a group called Gayesa. There's been a response to the words that are coming from Marco Rubio, from the Cuban foreign minister, who says the US Secretary of State lies once again to instigate military aggression that would provoke the shedding of Cuban and American blood. And in the middle of all of this, of course, is the Cuban people, who are growing increasingly fearful that military action is on some level on the horizon.
Will Grant, always good to speak to you. Thank you so much, Will.
It's 15 minutes past six, and this weekend, with lots of travel expected, with the bank holiday and half-term approaching, the EES, that's the entry-exit system, a digital border system that registers non-EU nationals travelling to the Schengen area, faces its first big test. And there have been warnings of long queues and significant delays. Is there any way to avoid them? Katie Austin will tell us, our transport correspondent. Good morning.
Good morning.
Katie, remind us, first of all, what's involved in the EES, and why is it thought there'll be such long queues as a result?
Sure. So for non-EU citizens, that obviously includes Brits, the entry-exit system involves registering fingerprints and a photo the first time you enter the block, alongside having your passport scanned. And then that's checked when you leave and on subsequent visits. There's been a gradual introduction of this new system since October, very gradual. But from April the 10th, that was meant to be the date it was fully up and running in all the countries involved. Now, in airports, where you come across this system after you land, there's been a mixed picture around Europe, I'd say, over the past few months. There have been some positive reports, but some bad queues in some places at busy times, maybe several hours at the worst, and a couple of reports of people missing flights home as a result. Greece, by the way, has said no biometrics will be taken for Brits this summer, making it a bit of an exception, I think. We've talked about airports there, but actually there are a few places in the UK where the French border is sort of crossed on UK soil as you leave. Now, that's the Shortsea crossings. So if you're taking a ferry from Dover, the Eurostar train for St Pancras, or the Eurotunnel from Folkestone. So at those places, actually, the French authorities haven't yet turned on the automated machines where you do these checks actually as you leave the country. The implication being, I think the tech isn't quite ready at those places yet. However, border police are still doing a bit of the process because they're kind of obliged to since April the 10th. And at Dover in particular, they are worried, I think, that that slight extra bit of the process, it's to do with police basically creating border police creating a file for each person. They think that could end up with some delays at Dover over this weekend, which of course will be very busy because of the May half term getaway. And May half term, I think, looks like the biggest test of this system overall so far.
Yeah, and I think the Port of Dover has said please don't arrive too early to minimise the queues. Katie Austin, thank you very much indeed.
17 minutes past six, extraordinary goings on in the world of technology over the past week. Massive IPOs expected for companies like OpenAI and SpaceX. And a lot to talk about with the boss of Amazon in the UK, Sean, including about this whole idea of price caps.
Yeah, and actually fascinating to think, you know, our predecessors 20-odd, 30 years ago would have been talking about Amazon in the same terms we're talking about OpenAI and ChatGPT and everything at the time. And fast forward, here we are today, Amazon having such a massive impact on our lives. I've been chatting to the boss of Amazon here in the UK, John Bamfrey, and we touched on loads of areas. What might happen if oil prices stay above $100 a barrel? Could that mean higher prices for them? We talked about UK tax affairs for Amazon, its relationship with suppliers as well. After seven, we'll hear more about what he thinks about work experience. He says that work experience for younger people should be mandatory in the UK. And a big topic for this week, as you mentioned, Amol, after we learned that the government has been pressing supermarkets to cut costs for shoppers, I asked if that was something Amazon would be prepared to do and to what extent.
We speak to government about all kinds of topics. And if they wanted to have that conversation, of course, we're going to engage with them. We would have a good discussion. And my view would be, you know, the UK grocery market is one of the most competitive in the world. And the market does a much better job of keeping the prices low than government intervention. And I think you heard some probably starker views expressed on that yesterday from other retail CEOs.
We hear retailers want to keep prices lower, but What are the pressures within your business that is making that harder to do?
Well, look, I think if you look at that at a couple of different levels, if you think globally, you know, there's conflict in the Middle East, there's global trade tensions. If you come into the UK and if you look over the last 2 or 3 years, the cost of doing business has gone up. You look at those pressures that have come through in things like the national minimum wage. If you look at some of those other cost pressures. Now, as a business, we have to figure out how we address those. But we've also taken decisions to put up costs almost voluntarily, our own costs, by investing in salaries. So we have put up our entry-level pay to almost £30,000 outside of London. And so, yes, there are cost pressures, but we're also investing very heavily in our people. And one of the main reasons for that is we frankly can't find enough skilled people to do the jobs that we need.
What have been the direct consequences of that war in Iran for Amazon?
Fuel prices have gone up, and that's inescapable, and that's had an impact on energy. So we've seen that like any other global business. For some of the products, maybe not just the Strait of Hormuz, but things like the Suez Canal, it means that products take a little bit longer to get here. And that just means we have to be placing orders earlier and maybe ordering in higher volumes than we would have done before.
And that higher fuel cost, is that starting to mean higher prices that you're having to put on your website?
We are not seeing as yet any impact on customer prices. It is impacting our business, our costs. But at the moment, we're not seeing that translate through to any impact on customers.
Are you expecting that that might be the case if the oil price stays above $100 a barrel for a longer period of time?
Well, I think sustained pressure on cost could have an impact. But the way that we set prices at Amazon actually isn't based on our cost. If I take a step back, what we've always tried to do is make sure that customers can find the lowest price when they come on to Amazon. And what that means is we will look at all the other national competitors who are offering similar products, and we'll aim to match the lowest of those prices. Let's say there are five competitors carrying a particular item and four of them put their prices up, but one of them keeps it down. Amazon will keep that price down at the lowest level.
A lot of other retailers, maybe on high streets, independents around the country, might sort of hear what you're describing and just feel like it's not a level playing field for them in a time of some of the biggest price crunches that we've seen for decades, and we've had, you know, a couple of them now in the space of a few years, that actually Amazon is able to really put the squeeze on to in the industry in places where they're not able to. And one of the things that benefits Amazon is the money that the business is able to make globally on such quite a phenomenal scale.
I understand where that question comes from, but actually when you look at our business, the majority of our revenue actually comes from those small and medium-sized businesses, actually many of whom will be on the high street as well. So there's no way that we can be successful unless we're helping those small businesses to be successful. But, you know, make no mistake, we face exactly the same pressures that many of those businesses do. You know, we're a top five business rates payer in the UK, and we have to work hard every single day to make sure our costs are down, and that enables us to keep prices down for customers and also to support about 6 in 10 high street businesses who choose to sell online, many of whom will sell on Amazon.
All of the we've discussed, and there are plenty of other things as well that we could get into about Amazon and the growth of this technology, the type of services that are being provided. Are they improving people's living standards? Because we keep talking about, and have for years now, a cost of living crunch. People don't feel like their lives are getting better. But at the same time, technology is advancing faster than it has in our lifetimes. The big tech companies like Amazon are getting bigger and bigger and richer, but people don't feel better off.
I agree that technology is advancing faster than at any time in our history. If you look at the stats on something like ChatGPT, it hit 100 million users in 2 months, 4 times faster than TikTok, 15 times faster than Instagram. Now, it's also true that customers are really feeling the pinch, and they've felt that since 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine, and they're still feeling that today. That's why we spend so much time focused on customers and asking ourselves, how do we make sure we're able to offer the products they want at low prices?
One of the ways many people might think you can sort of rebalance it and empower communities a bit more themselves is tax. So if the tax from the profits that are made by businesses around the country is distributed in a fairer way, more of that money might end up in those communities for them to make their own decisions about what they might be doing. Do you think we are getting to a point where we need to ask a big question about whether this is actually working for people and whether, you know, big tech companies like yourselves need to pay more tax?
Well, look, what we do every year is we produce a report about how much tax we pay. And I think it would surprise people to know that last year we contributed more than £5.8 billion.
So this is totting up all the national insurance contributions and everything that, you know, businesses don't often talk in those terms, do they? But Amazon do, because you don't say how much corporation tax.
Well, what we do, we pay £1 billion of direct tax, which includes corporation tax, which includes business rates, which includes national insurance, employer contribution, which includes digital services tax. And if you look in the UK, there are fewer than 10 firms that pay £1 billion worth of tax. We've always paid...
Not many firms sell, what is it, £30 billion worth of stuff to the around the UK, though, do they?
Well, we are... Look, there's no getting away from it. We are a big business. Of course, we pay all the tax we're meant to pay. But when you think about our contribution, it isn't just the amount of tax we pay. It's also the 75,000 jobs we create and the impact we have in communities. We did a report with Public First that we published last month about what happened when we went to Stockton-on-Tees. We opened a fulfillment centre there in 2023. There's a multibank there, which has helped almost one in three households in that region. But also you find we're paying £3,000 more than average entry-level wages, and the welfare bill went down and the tax bill went up in the local community because we're offering high-paid jobs, well-paid jobs to people who might otherwise be unemployed. So that's an example of the impact we have. I understand the question. It's really important that we are having a positive impact in communities right across the UK.
John Bamfrey, Country Manager of the United Kingdom for Amazon. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Sean.
You can hear all of that interview in the latest episode of Big Boss Interview Podcast on BBC Sounds. Lots more chat about work at Amazon. He's got bad news for people who watch football on dodgy fire sticks. And we talked about why large language models like OpenAI's ChatGPT have become one of Amazon's biggest rivals, which takes us nicely into the conversation with Jane Foley, Head of FX Strategy at Rabobank. Good morning, Jane. OpenAI, you know, we've talked a lot about space this week and Elon Musk's ambitions for its listing on a stock market and how much that might be worth, the trillions and gazillions. But OpenAI now looking to make similar steps. Are the stories linked?
Oh, well, those stories are linked for a long time because, of course, the two leaders of these companies are big rivals. And it is true. We have news that maybe as soon as today, potentially, that we could have a listing for OpenAI. And, of course, the timing is important here because investors only have so much money to go around. And if they are thinking about investing in SpaceX, well, maybe they want to save a little bit of money here for OpenAI. And, of course, there's another name that is speculated to go public this year too, and that, of course, Anthropic. So OpenAI potentially wanting to get ahead of Anthropic, putting their wares on the table, so to speak, to line investors up for a potential IPO listed maybe as soon as today, but it could go public as soon as September.
Very interesting. Well, we'll try to sort of cut through the hype as we always do at this point of the morning as that story progresses. Just quickly, Jane, a reflection on the week, whether it's the cost of UK government borrowing, the price of oil. What's been the story of the last few days?
Well, all of those stories, of course, and they're linked as well. Now, if we look at the gilts market, that, of course, has been back in the headlines, and it's never good news when the gilts market is making mainstream headlines. But gilt yields are off their highs of the week, which is better news, of course. That, of course, is wrapped up in the political uncertainties in the UK as well as the economic news. UK CPI inflation, a little bit softer than expected. Good news for gilts today. And also Andy Burnham, who, of course, could be a contender for a potential leadership challenge, did say that he would stick to Reeves as fiscal Reeves. That rules. That helped calm the gilt market too, as did the poor economic data. Bad news for the economy is good news for gilts.
Jane, thank you for your time this morning. Jane Foley of Rabobank. So when those gilt yields are off their highs, that means the cost of government borrowing coming down a little bit. I'll be back after 7 with more from the Amazon boss on his desires to see work experience be mandatory.
And we look forward to seeing you then. Thank you very much, Sean. It's coming up to 6:30 and time for some sport with Mike.
Katia, thank you. Today is the day for England's World Cup hopefuls. The 26 players who have been selected in Thomas Tuchel's final squad for the World Cup next month will be announced at 10 a.m. this morning. Now, plenty of rumours already circulating about who is in and who is out. And if reports are to be believed, there are several high-profile omissions.
Now Foden finds a position and scores! That's super from Phil Foden.
Gibbs-White shoots and he scores a brilliant goal! Morgan Gibbs-White, that's another cracker!
And it's Cole Palmer back in business. Trademark celebration from him after a trademark Cole Palmer finish.
Yes, Manchester City's Phil Foden, Nottingham Forest forward Morgan Gibbs-White and Cole Palmer of Chelsea all reported to have been left out of England's World Cup squad by Thomas Tuchel. Here's the thoughts of the former England defender Phil Jagielka. He's not overly surprised by Foden and Palmer missing out.
It's just not been probably a great season for either, and we have got, you know, a pool of talent in that position that have probably outperformed them at club level. Normally with England, you sort of get to keep your place on your sort of name, but obviously Tuchel's come in and wants to pick people on forms with obviously the chemistry between the team, the players.
Harry Maguire and Trent Alexander-Arnold also reported both to have missed out on a ticket to the World Cup. Striker Ivan Toney, though, who plays his football in the Saudi Arabian League, is expected to be included. Well, this squad, as we say, announced at 10 a.m. this morning. You can get it in full on the BBC Sport website, and we will preview it with correspondent John Murray in the next hour of the programme. Finally, as we head into the final weekend of the Premier League season, shall we hear from the manager of the newly crowned English champions? Mikel Arteta spoke to the media for the first time yesterday since Arsenal won the title on Tuesday evening. They did so, you'll remember, without even kicking a ball after Manchester City dropped points at Bournemouth. But Arteta revealed he didn't even watch the game.
I went outside to the garden, I started to build some fire and I started to do some barbecue. I didn't watch any of it. I was just hearing some noises in the background, in the living room, and suddenly the magic happened. My oldest son opened the garden door, he started to run towards me, he started to cry, he gave me a hug and said, "We are champions, Daddy." And then my other two boys and my wife came over, and it was beautiful. Just to see that joy on them as well, that they are always with me, it was magical. And I think a minute later, Martin was with the video. "Where are you?" I said, "Come over." He said, yeah, "Guys, enjoy for a while and see you in a few hours somewhere in London." It's one of the best feelings I ever had.
Martin there being the captain of Arsenal, Martin Odegaard, because the players all watched it together at the training ground, London Colney. Arteta, as we heard, wasn't there, decided to stay at home with his family. What a lovely, wholesome moment there. Your son running up to you saying, Daddy, we're champions. And he had that lovely moment with his family, his wife and children. But then he went into London and stayed up all night with the players and celebrated. So best of both worlds.
There's some evidence of the celebrations around.
Yes.
Floating around on social media. Mike, thank you very much indeed. It is 28 minutes to 7. Here's what's coming up tomorrow morning.
From BBC Radio 4, the life story of Miles Davis.
If I couldn't create, I wouldn't want to be here. It would be nothing for me to live for.
We're peeling back the many layers of a defiantly forward-looking musical genius who revolutionized jazz again and again and again.
What I was excited about, at every step, there was something new. Even if you had success with it, you needed to move forward.
Join me, Clark Peters, as we trace the journey of a true original.
His mother keeps pushing him to go to the violin, and he pushes back.
Legend. The Miles Davis Story.
Starts tomorrow morning at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. It's 27 minutes to 7 and you're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Katia Adler. And we have a summary of the news for you from Lisa Costello.
The Green Party says social media posts shared by its former candidate in the Makerfield by-election, which described the attack on Jewish ambulances in North London as a false flag, don't reflect the views of the party. Chris Kennedy was announced as the Green candidate yesterday, but withdrew hours later, citing personal and family reasons. The Green Party said Mr. Kennedy told them he had deleted the posts and apologised for any offence caused. The US Secretary of State has warned that Cuba's leaders will not be able to buy time in their conflict with Washington. Marco Rubio described Cuba as a threat to US national security a day after Washington charged Havana's former communist leader Raul Castro with murder over the shooting down of two planes in 1996. Mr. Rubio made the comments before boarding a flight to Sweden, where foreign ministers are gathering for a NATO summit. He said President Trump was very disappointed with NATO members, accusing them of failing to support the US with its conflict in Iran. Detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office have made a fresh appeal for information from the public. It's understood detectives are concerned that potential witnesses might think they're focusing only on the allegation that the former prince leaked confidential government files to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied wrongdoing in relation to his association with Epstein and has denied making any personal gain from his role as a UK trade envoy. The parents of five of the girls who were injured in a knife attack at a Taylor Swift-themed dance class in Southport have told the BBC they feel their daughters are being forgotten. Some of the parents say they've received insufficient support because of the anonymity given to them by the courts. Sefton and Lancashire councils said they continue to provide support for those affected by the attack. At the 71st Ivor Novello Awards in London, George Michael has been posthumously awarded a Fellowship of the Ivors Academy. Lily Allen received the Outstanding Song Collection Prize.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It's 24 minutes to seven. So, there is new guidance from the EHRC, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, on how to interpret and practically act on last year's Supreme Court ruling that biological sex should be the basis of the Equality Act. Alison Holt is our social affairs editor. Alison, good morning. Just take us through the guidance. What does the guidance say?
Well, it is taking that ruling from the Supreme Court last year that in the Equality Act, the term sex refers to biological sex. So in terms of this EHRC guidance, what it says is that where there are single sex services, they should be based on biological sex, not gender. So for instance, a trans woman, a biological male who identifies as a woman, should not use women-only facilities or services. The guidance also says it's really clear that transgender people who also have protections from discrimination, that they should not be forced to use services that align with their biological sex, because that could amount to discrimination against them. Instead, it advises third spaces or gender neutral spaces should be offered. Now, I should say this goes before Parliament. It's been laid before Parliament. Parliament now has 40 working days to raise any issues. After that, it would become statutory unless something major is raised.
And we've got the boss of the EHRC on at 8:10. One of the things that we're going to put to it, Alison, is that this is not actually guidance for employers, is it? So if you're someone who employs people, you run an organisation, you've got staff who are asking you questions, we still await that guidance.
So that's correct. It doesn't cover that, but it is for public-facing services. So that includes a huge range of organisations, from local authorities, government departments, charities, voluntary organisations, parks, leisure centres, etc., etc. It's where there is a public, where it's open to the public in some way. It doesn't cover employers, but I should say that the Supreme Court ruling has still affected many of the decisions being made in employment tribunals that we've seen around sex and, well, around single-sex spaces. It's starting to filter through in those terms. So I'd say that there is at least an overlap in terms of the types of issues that are being raised, although this guidance itself is not specifically about that.
We'll come back to this at 10 past 8. Alison Holt, our social affairs editor, thank you.
It's 22 minutes to 7, and detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office have repeated their call for people to come forward with information. Daniel Sanford is our Home Affairs correspondent. Morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
Can you tell us why detectives are making this call now? The Daily Mail's reporting this morning it's unprecedented. Could you sort of bring us up to date as to where the police investigation is?
Yeah, so people will remember that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was arrested back in February after some information in the publicly released Epstein files suggested that he might have leaked confidential information to Jeffrey Epstein. That's when Thames Valley started their investigation. That's when they arrested Andrew briefly before releasing him under investigation. That's when the searches happened at Royal Lodge in Windsor and at Andrew's temporary home in Norfolk. Since then, we haven't really had a significant update from Thames Valley Police, but they did put out an update this morning in which at the centre it was an appeal for fresh information, but also a reminder from the Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright that misconduct in public office is a crime that can take different forms, making this a complex investigation. And I understand what is behind that is a concern by detectives that people might think they're just looking at the possible release of confidential information and that people are only going to come forward about that aspect of the alleged behaviour of the former prince. And they've kind of pointed us to, well, what can misconduct in public office actually entail? And if you actually look at the definition of it, it's quite a wide range of behaviours, things like financial misconduct, sexual misconduct, abuse of position, misconduct leading to personal gain, corruption. And so I think that what behind it is they're wanting people to consider, right, well, what information might they have that might fit into that broader definition of misconduct in public office. They also said that they're still in negotiations with the Department of Justice about the original documents for the Epstein files, and my understanding is that they've not actually received any of the originals from the Department of Justice at this stage. So they're still relying on what has been released publicly, and of course that is also being redacted, so there is some issues with that, but also wouldn't be any good in evidence in a sort of formal police investigation.
Daniel Sanford, Home Affairs correspondent for now. Thank you.
19 minutes to 7. Five held in Tameside election fraud investigation. That's a headline on the BBC News website. Let's turn to that story and indeed wider British politics with Harry Farley, our political correspondent. Harry, morning. What can you tell us about what's been happening in Tameside?
Morning, Emily. So four men, one woman have been arrested, aged between 23 and 47. And a spokesman for Greater Manchester Police said that in the days leading up to and following the election on 7th of May, so those big elections earlier this month, we, that's Greater Manchester Police, received reports surrounding concerns about candidates within the St Peter's ward. Now, that particular ward was the only one that Labour won in the elections. They defeated an independent candidate who came second. All other 18 seats up for election in Tameside all went to Reform UK. And the police said that following initial inquiries last week, we've launched a full investigation into the allegations. And the spokesman continued, the work is specifically investigating the process of how candidates were put forward and represented in the ward and if this adhered to the relevant legislation and electoral procedures. A Labour Party spokesman said no evidence has been presented of any Labour Party involvement, and we categorically reject any suggestion that the party was involved, and it's understood that those arrested are not Labour members.
And meanwhile, Harry, in Makerfield, we've got this by-election in June the 18th, huge stakes, and there have been issues for both the Green and the Reform candidates.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, all parties really battling with the issue of candidates and their previous social media use, particularly Reform UK and the Greens in this case. Reform say they are standing by Robert Kenyon. There's been a series of questions about his previous social media use. The campaign group Hope Not Eight have published posts that it says came from his ex-account that shows sexist, violent, homophobic messages. There was a separate ex-account owned by him that was terminated by the social media company in 2024. And there was also a now deleted Facebook page where the anti-fascist campaign groups claimed that he was friends with three far-right organisers. A spokesman for Reform said they fully back Robert Kenyon. And in reference to those posts published by Hope Not Hate, they said that they were comments made before he was in politics, and added, Rob isn't a polished professional politician and doesn't speak like one. For the Greens, they announced their candidate yesterday morning, a local nurse called Chris Kennedy, but by yesterday afternoon, he had withdrawn and cited personal and family reasons. But The Times has reported on social media posts of his where he described an attack on Jewish ambulances in North London earlier this year as a false flag, essentially meaning that they were staged. The Green Party has said that doesn't reflect the party's group views. They'd spoken to Chris. He's now deleted them and he apologises for the offence caused. Meanwhile, the Conservatives have selected the former mayor of Wigan, Michael Winstanley, as their candidate. And you can find a full list of the others on the BBC News website.
Certainly can. Harry Farley, our political correspondent. Thank you.
16 minutes to seven, and the Chancellor Rachel Reeves came to the Commons yesterday to promise cheaper family days out, part of what she called a Great British Summer Savings Campaign. But her opponents gave the package a very lukewarm reception, and the Speaker wanted to know why MPs had been the last to hear about it. David Cornock reports.
On Tuesday, Rachel Reeves was loudly heckled by the driver of a white van at a petrol station in Yorkshire. Yesterday, a son of Lancashire had a go.
These backbenchers of either side are elected to this house to hear it first. Not to be outside a Morrison's petrol station, not to be on a bus, not doing it to TikTok.
The Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, crossed once again that MPs had been the last to hear the news. Most of what Rachel Reeves had to say did have a familiar air. One reason, perhaps, the Commons was half empty. But there were some surprises in her 10-minute speech.
I recognise that what matters for families is not just getting by, but being able to enjoy time together without worrying about the next bill. That is why I am launching the Great British Summer Savings Scheme to help families and support our hospitality sector. So I can today announce a temporary cut in the rate of VAT on summer attractions from 20% to 5% over the summer holidays.
She said this would benefit visitors to museums, theme parks and soft play areas. After days of speculation about food price freezers and caps, the Chancellor also announced cuts to import taxes on some basic foods and told supermarkets to pass them on. There was help too for people who have to use their cars for work, but her Conservative shadow, Sir Mel Stride, was underwhelmed.
Today's announcements will bring little comfort to the hundreds of thousands of people who have lost their jobs, to the countless businesses that have folded, and to those high streets which are now hollowed out.
Daisy Cooper for the Lib Dems thought the package welcome but overdue. She'd also been looking at the weather forecast.
We are due to have a very hot summer, and that means that outdoor attractions will have huge demand because children will want to be outside in this hot weather. Indoor attractions, such as soft play centres, will not benefit so much because there won't be much demand in the summer months.
Rachel Reeves thought they'd be OK, with a little help from Daisy Cooper's Action Man boss.
I've had enough family holidays in the UK to know that there are plenty of days when it's raining, and I'm sure that the leader of the Liberal Democrats will be visiting a soft play centre soon.
The SNP's Kirsty Blackman was worried the Chancellor was paying for it all by changing the way some oil and gas company profits were taxed. She wondered whether
they have modelled the job losses that may occur as a result of this change in policy, and if she can tell the House how many job losses she thinks might occur because of this change in the oil and gas taxation regime.
The Chancellor said she was closing a tax loophole to bring the UK into line with other countries. Reform UK's Robert Jenrick, a former Tory MP, tried to put Rachel Reeves on the spot.
Will the Chancellor confirm that, assuming she intends to stay in office for the rest of this Parliament, she won't be increasing taxes on working people at all for the rest of this Parliament?
I will take absolutely no lessons from the man who was part of a party that took our economy to its knees. Inflation at 11%. Working people worse off at the end of the last parliament than they were at the beginning. The worst parliament ever for living standards.
The Greens thought Rachel Reeves could have gone further. Plaid Cymru wanted more on heating bills. A support package for the ceramics industry went down particularly well among Labour MPs from the Potteries.
What a day to be a Stokey! Yeah.
David Williams, whose mum used to work in ceramics.
The good news is my mum's watching again right now at home. She's clearly happy because I've had a free word text and it says, nice one, duck.
Another Labour MP, Adam Thompson, made Rachel Reeves an offer.
Can I thank the Chancellor for her statement and particularly given her VAT cut on theme park tickets, first invite her and all honourable members to join me on my annual trip to Alton Towers this summer.
The Chancellor was happy to bask in those warm words but carefully sidestepped the invite. After the last few weeks at Westminster, she's probably had enough of roller coasters for a while.
That was David Cornick reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. The time now is 11 minutes to 7. How should we stop private companies that provide services to councils, including children's social care, from ripping those councils off? What about a statutory price cap? That is an idea that's been around for a few days in the context of retailers, of course. Now there is a proposal from the government to stop private providers of care from profiteering, as the government puts it, lest they drive councils into bankruptcy. It's worth saying there is huge variation across the country, of course, in the degree to which care, whether it's children's services or other forms of social care, is self-funded, i.e. comes from individuals, or comes from councils. Councillor Amanda Hopgood is the chair of Children, Young People and Families, the committee that looks after them at the local government association, and also a councillor in Durham. Councillor Hopgood, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. How do you think these proposals might make a difference?
Well, I think for so long we've had caps in adult services, and local authorities and local government have been calling for the same caps in children's services, because we do feel that we have been overcharged. Demand is quite high. At certain times, you don't have any control of demand of children's services. If a child's in need, they're in need, and we need to deal with it. And there is this profiteering that appears to take place.
So you feel that you've been charged a really high price for not necessarily a good service, and that if there was a price cap, it might be that basically you've got a bit more money for the other services you need to provide.
Yes, and the money that is raised, that is charged for child services, should be spent on the children. They are the priority, not to be profiteering big companies to make money on something that is actually essential for some people in life.
And what sort of pressure are councils like the council that you're in Durham, Amanda, what sort of pressure are you under right now?
So these are statutory services, both children and adult services. So we do have, so it is demand led. And just some examples of residential care costs. In 2023-24 for children's services was £3.1 billion.
Okay. And so if councils are under that sort of pressure, there are some people, Amanda, that would say that actually there is a case for the profit motive. Because some people would say if councils are really struggling, if public money is tight, as we know it is, isn't there a case for incentivising private companies to get involved, including by making profits if need be, because they might be able to provide a service where the councils are struggling?
The money that councils spend on this should be spent on the children, not to be just rolling private investors. I absolutely get that there are times that we will need to have private placements because the whole country isn't the same. We have lots of rural areas where the demand is very different. The demand on things like home to school transport, the costs are significantly higher when you're really struggling to get staff in some of our rural communities. So I'm not saying that there isn't a place for this, but there is a time and a place, and that's right now, where we need to stop the profiteering. We need to stop, for example, them being able to offer wages that are 3 and 4 times the normal average of what someone who works in one of these, and managers, a care home would normally be paid.
And so it's worth saying, so Nadra Ahmed, who's from the National Care Association, says, why would a social care provider not be allowed to make a profit from a business? It's their investment. Just one final very quick thought from you, Amanda. What would you like to see happen now to make your life easier to provide these services?
We'd like to see government be able to provide the funding that's needed to local government. It's a statutory service. We have to provide it. And everyone across the board is absolutely clear that these children come first.
Yeah.
And we need to make sure that we provide the best service we can. But it needs to be fully funded.
It needs to be funded. All right. Councillor Amanda Hopgood from Durham, thank you very much indeed.
6 minutes to seven. Great British Summer Savings is how the government is branding announcements from the Chancellor this week. Rachel Reeves wants to try and get across that, yes, she gets it. For all of that swirling political noise about who should maybe lead the Labour Party, that the government understands the cost of living remains the number one issue for millions of families. But what about her measures? Do they go far enough? Paul Novak is the General Secretary of the TUC. Good morning to you.
Morning, Katya.
So the Business Secretary, Peter Kyle, said in Parliament yesterday, I'm not going to apologise for throwing the kitchen sink at the cost of living challenges we inherited. Do these measures feel like the kitchen sink to you?
Well, I think they're absolutely a step in the right direction. And, you know, support for businesses. We've just heard about the support for the ceramics industry, but £470 million of much needed support for not just ceramics or chemicals industry as well. A practical boost to workers in terms of mileage rates. At the moment, it is crazy that care workers are losing out as they travel between different jobs and assignments. And obviously support for families to allow families to, you know, enjoy the nice things in life, a day out for the kids. I think obviously, as we move through into the autumn and as people start to be hit by higher heating bills again, we're going to need to see more for the government. But listen, we're always saying to the government, it needs to do more to show it's on the side of working people. I think this is starting to show that the Chancellor is listening and acting.
OK, starting. But the government in Scotland is proposing a price cap on certain food staples. As you say, people are worrying about the winter, energy prices, inflation of food prices. And what about Wes Streeting? He's talking about promoting a wealth tax if possible. Yeah. Do you agree with those two measures?
Well, I'm not quite sure how you would make a sort of blunt price cap in supermarkets work, but absolutely anything that any government can do in Holyrood or in Westminster or in Cardiff to bear down on the cost of living has got to be welcomed.
So is that yes to a wealth tax?
Well, on the issue of wealth taxes, the TUC has been very clear for a long time that government needs to do more to build on the measures they've already done to tax wealth. We've got this huge inequality in our country between those who have wealth and those who don't. And I think it's absolutely sensible that those who earn their income through going out to work every day shouldn't be in a position where they're paying higher marginal rates of tax than those who get income from properties and shares. And just to say, that's a sort of common sense measure that has support right across the political spectrum. If you talk to, and we've polled over 4,000 people in the wake of those election results a couple of weeks ago. If you talk to people who voted Reform, who voted Green, who voted Labour, who voted Conservative, they support more effective taxes on wealth, more effective taxes on large bank profits, as well as things like workers' rights.
Yeah, you did some polling in the aftermath of the local elections and elections for the devolved parliament. Almost double those who named immigration as a top priority were those who said cost of living, 65%. Yeah, can the Labour Party win back the confidence of the working people, do you think?
I think they can, and I think they can do it by tilting towards those common sense issues that would improve lives for millions of people. Far too many people in this country feel that politics isn't working for them. So how do you deliver that change the government promised them back in July 2024? We've just talked about wealth taxes. Delivering the manifesto in full, that includes delivering that package of new employment rights, again, popular with Reform voters and Labour voters and Green voters. But you know what? The other thing I'd do in terms of restoring faith in politics is clean up our politics. I mean, the Mandelson scandal has left politics, faith in our politics, hanging by a thread.
Just one word answer. Is the way to do it to change the Prime Minister?
Well, I'm not going to speculate about playing number 10 top Trump's catcher. Whoever is in number 10 today, tomorrow, 5 years' time, 10 years' time, show you're standing up for working people.
Paul Novak, General Secretary of TUC. Thank you very much.
On BBC Sounds, there are podcasts to help you look after your body
and your mind.
From increasing your immunity
to feeling more confident. or tips on how to focus.
Sorry, what were you saying?
If it matters to you, it matters to us.
Feel good inside and out.
With What's Up Docs.
And Complex with Kimberly Wilson.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's 2 minutes to seven, time for the weather with Simon.
Katya, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. Well, the warmer weather is really ramping up as we go through the next few days. For many across England and Wales, there'll be lots of sunshine. But in the far southwest of England and the far west of Wales, here we are going to see some cloudier skies. And that could be a little bit stubborn to clear away. And it may even produce the odd spot of rain, actually, in the Isles of Scilly and West Cornwall this afternoon. Where you've got that cloud in the far west, temperatures will be around about 15 to 17 degrees. But further inland, across Wales and southwest England, temperatures around about 21 to 27 degrees. Across much of the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, sunshine from start till finish today, and it's going to feel much warmer. Temperatures widely 25 to 28 Celsius, perhaps even up to 30 degrees around Cambridgeshire. Across northern England, we'll see a little bit more cloud around the Lake District, the far northwest, and temperatures here 17 to 21. Elsewhere, temperatures today with the sunshine 22 to 26 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, mostly cloudy today and staying predominantly dry until later on, where we could see a bit of showery rain, highs of 17 to 19. And across Scotland, again, generally quite cloudy. Some showers affecting northern and western areas where it's quite cool, 13 to 18 Celsius. Some brighter skies in eastern and southeastern areas, highs of 19 to 22. But really, as we go through the bank holiday weekend, it's always the far north and west that will be cooler and a bit more cloudier. But elsewhere, lots of sunshine, temperatures widely mid to high 20s. Up to 33 degrees by Monday.
Simon, thanks so much.
It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 22nd of May. Good morning. The headlines. The man who spent just a few hours as the Green Party candidate in the Makerfield by-election has apologised for social media posts he shared about an attack on Jewish ambulances in London. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has described Cuba as a threat to America's national security. This as the US military continues its build-up in the region. Our correspondent Will Grant is on the ground there, assessing how Cubans view the prospect of an American attack.
Venezuela es Venezuela, pero Cuba es Cuba.
Venezuela is Venezuela and Cuba is Cuba, he said. And here we don't lack the courage for this moment.
And detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten Windsor have made a new appeal for people to come forward with information.
Also coming up, three teens have avoided jail terms for 11 rapes, which has sparked a new debate about how to tackle misogyny in young men. Former safeguarding minister Jess Phillips joins us at 10 to 8. And... yep, that is obviously the sound of emperor penguins, which are endangered, but not yet specially protected. What future for our flightless friends? The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The Green Party says its former candidate in the Makerfield by-election has apologised for sharing social media posts that described the attack on Jewish ambulances in North London as a false flag. Chris Kennedy withdrew his candidacy yesterday, citing personal and family reasons, just hours after the party had announced him. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
When Chris Kennedy, a registered nurse and children's safeguarding specialist, was unveiled as the Green candidate in the upcoming Makerfield by-election yesterday morning, the party's leader, Zach Polanski, said he would make a fantastic representative for the area. But just a few hours later, he withdrew from the race. The party still insists that was for personal and family reasons. But last night, the Times newspaper reported that Mr. Kennedy had shared social media posts which described an attack on Jewish community ambulances in North London earlier this year as a false flag, a term which usually means staged. A spokesperson said the posts didn't reflect the views of the Green Party. They said they had spoken to Mr. Kennedy about the posts and said he had deleted them and apologised for any offence caused.
A full list of candidates in the Makerfield by-election is available on the BBC News website. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Cuba as a threat to US national security and warned that the chances of a peaceful agreement with the Caribbean nation are not high. Washington has been ramping up pressure on the communist government in Havana, including by charging Cuba's former president, Raul Castro, with murder over the shooting down of two planes in 1996. From Washington, here's our correspondent Joel Gunter.
Trump administration officials have previously alluded to the possibility of military action against Cuba, but Marco Rubio's latest remarks will take on added weight after the murder charges leveled against Raul Castro. Casting doubt on a diplomatic outcome, Mr. Rubio said the Trump administration was both very serious and very focused on changing the Cuban regime. His comments follow a build-up of U.S. military might in the region, with the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier and three escort warships arriving in the Caribbean Sea in recent days. Cuba's foreign minister yesterday denied that the country posed a threat to the U.S., saying the accusation was a pretext for U.S. aggression. Mr. Rubio also announced the arrest of the Miami-based sister of a Cuban official, the latest step in what is now a months-long pressure campaign against the island nation.
Mr. Rubio has now flown to Sweden for a meeting of NATO foreign ministers. Before he boarded the flight, he said President Trump was very upset with members of the Defence Alliance for going into hiding during the Iran war. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman is travelling with Mr. Rubio and sent this report from Helsingborg.
This is the first gathering of NATO foreign ministers since the start of the war on Iran, with the alliance under continuing strain over its fallout. The Trump administration has at times angrily demanded more help from its allies, many of whom have in turn privately shunned the risk of getting drawn into a war they don't see as part of NATO's mutual defence concept and which they weren't consulted about. Before boarding the plane to Sweden, asked by the BBC about unconfirmed reports the US could shrink its total troop numbers available in the event of an attack on a NATO country, Mr. Rubio said some of those issues would be discussed today. He added that President Trump remained very upset and disappointed with NATO allies. The NATO chief Mark Rutte had earlier told reporters NATO countries, including France, Germany and the UK, were moving assets to the region to ensure freedom of navigation.
Detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office have repeated their call for people to come forward with information. It's understood detectives are concerned that potential witnesses might think they're focusing only on the allegation that the former prince shared a confidential trade report with Jeffrey Epstein. Here's our UK correspondent, Daniel Sanford.
It was in February that Thames Valley Police detectives made the decision to arrest Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office. He was released under investigation later that day. The initial allegation arose out of the publicly released Epstein files and concerned the alleged leaking of government reports to Jeffrey Epstein. Today, detectives are making a fresh appeal for information and are stressing that their investigation is examining a number of aspects of alleged misconduct. It's understood that detectives don't want the public to think they're only interested in alleged leaks of confidential government files. Misconduct in public office is a very complex offence, which potentially can include a wide range of behaviour, including abuse of position, sexual misconduct and corruption, amongst other things. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor has consistently denied wrongdoing in relation to his association with Epstein and has denied any personal gain from his role as a UK trade envoy.
Official figures released in the past few minutes show that government borrowing, the difference between total public sector spending and income, was £24.3 billion last month. That's 25% more than in April 2025, according to the Office for National Statistics. The number of new melanoma skin cancer cases in the UK has risen above 20,000 in a year for the first time. The charity Cancer Research UK says too much exposure to ultraviolet light from the sun or sunbeds is part of the cause. It says an estimated 9 out of every 10 cases are avoidable. Here's our health reporter, Michelle Roberts.
The most recent data for 2022 shows there were 20,980 new cases of melanoma diagnosed in the UK, the highest number ever seen in a year for this deadliest of skin cancers. Women are more likely to be diagnosed at younger ages because of more sun exposure, including sunbathing and sunbed use. Rates are higher in men in later age, linked to long-term sun exposure. Cancer Research UK says overdiagnosis, where cancers that would not go on to cause harm are identified, could also be playing a role in rising rates alongside increased awareness.
Yellow heat health alerts are due to come into force across some English regions this morning, including the Midlands, London, East Anglia and the South East, as parts of the UK prepare for a bank holiday heatwave. Temperatures in these areas could climb into the low 30s by Sunday and Monday. Pollen levels are also forecast to become very high in places. Lily Allen has received the Outstanding Song Collection Prize at the 71st Ivor Novello Awards, which celebrate excellence in songwriting and music composition. Sam Fender won Songwriter of the Year. George Michael, who died 10 years ago, was awarded a Fellowship of the Ivors Academy, as was the Radiohead frontman Tom York. And there was a special honour for Sir Elton John, as our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson reports from the ceremony in London.
Sir Elton John has a new job. He was the surprise guest as it was announced that he is to become the first ever president of the Ivors Academy, the organisation which formed in 1944 to represent songwriters. The plan is that he will use the role to advocate for the rights of musical creatives. And on stage, he made it clear it is a subject he is passionate about.
Creativity, when you're writing music or writing a song, is probably the greatest thing you can ever have. Music is the greatest gift you can possibly be given.
Other winners included the Irish singer C-Mat for Album of the Year. The Scottish indie folk singer Jacob Alon picked up two awards, including the Rising Star, and Sam Fender was named Songwriter of the Year.
Colin Patterson reporting.
Lisa, thank you so much. It's 9 minutes past seven. As Lisa mentioned there, in just the last few minutes, we have got the public borrowing figures. So borrowing for April 2026 was £24.3 billion. That was £4.9 billion, or 25% more than in April 2025, and about £3.4 billion more than forecast by the Office for Budget Responsibility. So slightly higher than had been predicted, slightly higher than the same month for last year. Let's try and get inside those figures and also put them into a broader context with Helen Miller, the Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Helen, good morning.
Good morning.
So first thoughts on the month itself, and then we put this into the bigger picture. That's slightly higher than expected, isn't it?
Ever so slightly higher than the OBR had expected, but these are monthly numbers are always fairly volatile, and it's a relatively small change compared to kind of the underlying borrowing. So I don't think we should over-calibrate to those monthly moves. It's also the case that the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility, back when they were doing their forecast at the spring forecast, didn't really expect borrowing this year to start falling below last year's numbers until later in the year. So yes, monthly borrowing is coming in a little bit higher, but I don't think we should read into that we're necessarily off track.
Absolutely. So the month-on-month figure is always, as you say, volatile. The bigger story is the underlying trend. What is that underlying trend? What is the trajectory in terms of the amount that is borrowed by the British state and the way in which it's kind of a growing share of what the government is spending money on?
Yeah. Well, big picture, the government has been consolidating, meaning they are bringing borrowing down. And the numbers today say, if anything, the ONS thinks that borrowing in the entire year up to March 2026 is very slightly lower than previously forecast. So now they think the government was borrowing 4.2% of national income. And that is lower than the previous year. So the government that has been delivering on its promised consolidation, it has been reducing the gap between how much it spends and how much it taxes. And that is due to continue under current plans. The government is due to continue bringing down borrowing substantially and moving, you know, eventually in a couple of years into a surplus position on the current plan. So again, I think the data today shows that the government has started delivering that consolidation, and on current plans they'll due to continue with that.
And on a related but separate point, what is the government's success or otherwise in terms of reducing the overall amount paid on debt interest?
Well, debt interest is hard to look at on a monthly basis. I mean, debt interest is now, big picture, just much more expensive than it was even a few years ago. And we've seen gilt yields, the amount that government has to pay to borrow, going up in recent times. that feeds through into kind of borrowing figures with a bit of a lag. So, and we'll have to see how it pans out. But the government is getting down the overall borrowing, but against this pressure of higher borrowing costs. And panning out even further, it is still the case that debt is high and actually still rising a little bit, which I think speaks to the scale of the challenge here. You have to be doing quite a lot on borrowing, even to start scaling, to start stabilising the debt. And we're not even doing that yet. So that the underlying challenge here is really pretty chunky.
And because of that underlying challenge, Helen, final thought, what does that mean in terms of the room for manoeuvre or otherwise that the government might have later this summer, when the impact of what's happening in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz might start to feed through with inflation and potentially the Bank of England having to raise interest rates to try and get control of that inflation?
You know, a big picture, I think, if we're thinking about room for manoeuvre in terms of tax and spend, you know, very limited. On the one hand, the government, you know, spends a huge amount of money. Yeah. It can always choose how to spend that money, and you can always spend that money differently. And that gives you, in some sense, quite a lot of room for manoeuvre. But if we're thinking about if the government, any government, wanted to do more, then we are very limited because we are hitting up against the fiscal rules. We're hitting up against how much the government says it wants to borrow and what it wants to do with debt. And as you said, there'll be lots of pressures making that situation worse. So I think, you know, the takeaway is that limited room for manoeuvre in terms of just spending more.
Helen Miller from the IFS, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
14 minutes past seven, and for the first time since the Iran war widened that rift between the United States and its allies in Europe, NATO's foreign ministers are meeting. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has just arrived. Foremost in European minds is the Trump administration saying it will incrementally withdraw the US from European security, something it's relied on for decades. Tom Bateman is our US State Department correspondent, traveling with Marco Rubio. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Katya.
So NATO's European members they're worried and also they're frankly confused. I mean, before heading to this meeting, Marco Rubio said President Trump was very disappointed in NATO. That's not something the US president has hidden. He said they went into hiding during the Iran war. Washington had said it's withdrawing thousands of troops from Germany and Poland. But then there was a surprise post last night on Truth Social, Donald Trump saying he's going to send 5,000 troops to Poland. What's going on?
I think on the latter point, we still don't have it clear what exactly, you know, what or when this will happen. It appeared to be President Trump reversing an earlier announcement by the administration that they wore down the number of American forces in Poland by 5,000. When that had been announced, it appeared as though they'd be literally wrenching soldiers out. It doesn't seem that that's the case. They were talking about not continuing with a planned deployment of a further 5,000 forces. But now President Trump is saying he will add 5,000 more forces to Poland. So that felt like a reversal. But I think on the, you know, the issue here about President Trump's anger at America's traditional allies, you know, to do with the Iran war is not abating. And I put that to the Secretary of State Marco Rubio just as before we headed off from Miami last night and asked him plainly, does Mr. Trump still regard America's allies as cowards, as he had put it? And Mr. Rubio did not demur from that. I mean, he said that the president and the administration remains very disappointed with NATO countries. And specifically, I asked about this point that has been reported in the last week, that the Americans could shrink the number of available forces that are pooled by NATO if and when a NATO ally is attacked. So the number of American soldiers would be available would be reduced. He said that they would discuss those issues. So there is still the sense of punishment from the Trump administration for NATO countries hanging over this summit.
Well, of course, NATO countries are saying, look, we're a defense alliance, not an offense alliance. And that's why, as an alliance, we couldn't take part in Iran. But behind the scenes, most NATO countries, they say, have been helping the U.S. administration, despite the headlines of certain countries like Italy not allowing US jets to refuel. This summit now is a staging post up to the NATO leaders summit that's going to be in Turkey in July. So in European circles, they're wondering, will Donald Trump turn up if he's still so angry, as you say?
Yeah, and I think really what this meeting is about is setting the stage for the summit in Ankara in July. So, you know, what Marco Rubio has to do here is get what they call some deliverables that he can go back to the White House with and say, I've got NATO countries to commit to this. So I think he will be putting some pressure on. It was notable that Mark Rutte, the NATO chief, in a press conference here yesterday, was at pains to point out that some of the things you're saying, that NATO countries have done a lot, he said, when it comes to Iran, when it comes to freedom of navigation in the region. He said that there were thousands of flights taking off from European bases. By that he means American military flights in support of US operations, that they were refueling, restocking at these bases. So pushing back at Mr. Trump's accusation that they've done nothing.
And hoping that he'll turn up in July. Tom Bateman, thank you very much. Travelling with the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and apologies for the sound going in and out a bit because Tom was on a bus.
It is 18 minutes past seven. We were talking a moment ago about the public borrowing figures. Another huge challenge for the government is unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, which is one of the subjects that came up in Sean's exclusive interview with the UK and Ireland country manager for Amazon, wasn't it, Sean?
It was, yes. We've had an 11-year high that we've seen this week of youth unemployment, 729,000, more than 16% of people aged between 16 and 24 classified as unemployed, more not in education, not in training as well. And John Bamfrey, who is that boss at Amazon in the UK, of course, it is the world's biggest online retailer, huge proportion of online sales here in the UK as well. We talked about lots of things. And one of the things that came up for them was their inability to recruit the number of skilled people that they need across the UK. And he thought one of the solutions could be mandatory work experience placements. He told me young people were unfairly portrayed.
Too often you read about young people that somehow they lack motivation, they lack resilience, they lack the will to develop skills. That is not our experience. We have to stop blaming young people. It's not a motivation problem, it's a system problem, and that requires a system response. So what I mean by that is, you know, our system isn't necessarily producing young people who are ready for work. And the most transformative thing that I've seen that helps young people is work experience. It could just be a week. If you get a T-level student and they come in for a week, they understand the value of teamwork, of communication, of problem solving, things that I don't think we teach in our curriculum, but that all employers are looking for. So I think what we need to do is think about things like, should we make work experience mandatory for 16 plus?
Do you think we should?
I think we should. I think, as I say, it's the most transformative thing I've seen. We employ 75,000 people. The majority of people work in our operations division, and almost half of them either come straight from education or from unemployment. So we see what these young people are like. We've got a program called Career Choice, where we'll pay up to £3,000 a year for our employees to get nationally recognised qualifications in some of the areas where we can't find enough roles. So it might be things like IT, data centre engineering, it might be software engineers, it might be IT or finance, bookkeeping, whole range of courses. We've had 30,000 people take those roles.
What is needed to happen to get more younger people getting work experience? Because this might be a bit anecdotal, just judging by the shows that we do. A lot of people might say, well, I get in touch with a load of businesses and they're not able to do this.
I think you need businesses to come together with local governments and further education colleges. And you need that to happen on a regional basis so that you can understand what the skills gaps are. And you can also encourage businesses, particularly large businesses like Amazon, like we do, to offer work experience. And indeed, to make sure that the education system is developing the type of skills that we need. But if I give you one example, Sean, of, you know, we work with some individuals who are probably furthest from work. And that's where we actually see the biggest transformation. One example is our program called Supported Internships, where we have a work experience program for young people with learning disabilities and autism. And if you read the stats about that group, they are horrifying. 95% of these young people are unemployed age 21. Their life expectancy is 10 years lower than national average, not because they have worse health outcomes, but because they have a lack of socialisation and purpose. And in this supported internship program, which we started about 4 years ago, we bring them into our warehouses, one of our fulfillment centres. They do college for an hour. They work, rotating around the different areas, have lunch with their colleagues, a bit more work, and then they finish off. On day one, they can't look you in the eye. They might be interrupting constantly throughout. After 9 months, you see this unbelievable transformation. They're giving presentations to their friends, their families, their colleagues. And what you see is people who are ready for work. And these are some of the hardest to reach young people.
And is the government assisting that? Are they providing an environment at the minute that encourages businesses to do that?
Yeah, I think they are. I think the youth guarantee that's recently been announced by the Department for Work and Pensions gets exactly after the challenge that we see. But, you know, when you look at the fact there's almost a million young people not in education, work or training, very clear that's a national crisis. And we need a really strong coordinated response. But it's very clear that is on the government's agenda.
So that's the UK boss of Amazon, John Bamfrey. You can hear plenty more on the Big Boss interview on BBC Sounds, as we've heard a bit this morning as well, talking about tax and prices and the like. After 8:30, we're going to be having a discussion, aren't we, with the head teacher, policy advisor, about how do you resolve that work experience issue.
Thanks, Sean. And amongst ourselves, we've been talking about heat waves. And as Amol mentioned earlier, you're dressed for it, Sean, so well done. But I need you to please focus your mind right now on the cold, on ice capes, and more specifically, penguins, even more specifically, emperor penguins. Those are the emperor penguins, and scientists say they need our help. The nations that govern Antarctica have been meeting in Hiroshima this week for an Antarctic Treaty Consultative Summit, but they stopped short of declaring a specially protected species status for emperor penguins. Dr. Peter Fretwell is senior scientist at the British Antarctic Survey. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tell us a bit about the emperor penguins. How serious is it for them that they haven't been granted this protected status?
Well, the emperor penguins are an incredible creature. It's adapted to survive some of the harshest and most brutal cold conditions in the world. It lives exclusively in Antarctica around the coastlines. So it breeds and lives on the sea ice, the frozen sea that surrounds that continent. And as the weather and the temperature and the climate warms around the world, we're finding that sea ice is breaking up and disappearing too soon, which is threatening the populations. And we're seeing those populations really decline over the last decade or so. This protection that the Antarctic Treaty meeting was going to provide would have given some local protection to the penguins from the things that we can protect against, like increased too many tourist visitations or fishing and things like that. It wouldn't protect against climate change, which is the main threat, but because their populations are decreasing so quickly, any protection we can give at the moment would be vital to them.
And why wouldn't they be awarded the status? I mean, why wouldn't you want to protect penguins?
Well, the consultative meeting is a consensus meeting where everybody has to agree. When we first proposed this about 5 years ago, the conversation was that some parties, just a small number of parties, didn't agree that they were actually endangered. So the scientists like myself have been out and been collating that evidence and proposing and finding those scientific papers. And we've now persuaded them that they're endangered, but those parties, the same parties, now are really bickering over how to protect them. They don't think this is the right way of protecting them and won't give them this protection status.
Well, I can hear from the tone of your voice, I don't think you'll give up on trying to get them protected. And what can be done, though, otherwise? I mean, as you say, climate change, it's a big issue, but what can be done to protect them and the ice they depend on?
Well, you can't put the ice back locally. You can't put the ice back. You can't really stop climate change on a local basis. It's a global problem. But emperor penguins are just really one small animal in a global environmental system, but they are something that we relate to. And they're really a warning about what's going to happen to many other species as the world warms over the coming decades. Emperor penguin is at the pointy end of this climate crisis, but as the world warms up in temperate and more tropical areas, the same problems that we're seeing with emperor penguins will start to occur for many other species that we love around the world.
Dr. Peter Fretwell, Senior Scientist at the British Antarctic Survey, thank you.
27 minutes past seven, Mike is here with the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hello again, Amal. Well, you've had recent experience, haven't you, of sitting in a room with a group of people waiting nervously to hear whether your name is called out or not. Well, that is a similar experience to what many England footballers will be going through today. The big question for them is, has manager Thomas Tuchel stayed faithful to them, or are they to be banished from the World Cup squad? Yes, this is the big announcement set for 10 a.m. this morning, where we will find out the 26 names on the plane for England heading to the World Cup next month. Well, correspondent John Murray will be at Wembley to hear that news as it gets announced. He's with us now. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning from Wembley.
Plenty of rumours already circulating, isn't there, about who's in, who's out? In fact, these aren't really rumours now, are they? A lot of this now seems dead cert about who has and who hasn't made the plane. Just give us some of the headlines. What's caught your eye?
Well, what we know for sure is that Harry Maguire is not included in the squad because he's broken cover already and put out a post on social media to say that he's shocked and gutted to be left out. In fact, his mother's joined in. His mother, Zoe, has also put out a post to say she's disgusted by the fact that Harry Maguire's not being included in Thomas Tuchel's squad. Other than Maguire, it looks like neither Phil Foden nor Cole Palmer are going to be included in the squad. They've both long been seen as rising stars of the England team, but they've not been at their best, either of them, this season. Morgan Gibbs-White is another one who has been in very good form in recent months. In fact, he scored as many Premier League goals as any England qualified player this season, but it seems that he has not made the cut. And I think a big surprise is the seeming inclusion of Ivan Toney, the Saudi Arabian-based striker, who's played only a handful of minutes over Tuchel, but it looks as though he is in with Ollie Watkins as the potential backup to Harry Kane.
Yeah, that is an eyebrow raiser, isn't it? I guess all this, John, shows that Thomas Tuchel, really no respecter of name or pedigree when it comes to this England side.
Yeah, I think he has players who he wants in his England squad when it comes to the World Cup. Players like Jordan Henderson. John Stones is interesting, who's barely played, but Thomas Tuchel wants him in the squad. And Dan Byrne is another one of Newcastle United who is a player who may not be on the field very much during the course of the tournament, but Thomas Tuchel likes him in the squad. And I think that other area, that very competitive area where Palmer and Foden have not made it, well, included Bukayo Saka, Eze, Anthony Gordon, Madueke, Rashford, that's who they've lost out to, and that is a very competitive area for selection.
Not long to go to find out for sure. At 10 a.m. that squad is announced, and John will be reporting it across all BBC outlets. You can follow it on the BBC website, BBC Sport website as well, of course. And just to say, as we head into the last weekend of the Premier League, in the next hour we will cast our eye back and have our very own Today programme review of the football season that's coming up in an hour.
Thank you, Mike. Let's hear from Anna and Jeffrey.
The new series of Add to Playlist
on BBC Radio 4. We put together five pieces of music to create a totally unique playlist.
He wanted to really emulate the Paris boulevards, the beeping of the horns, yes. Yeah. Chaos in Paris.
And we're joined by two studio guests to help us compile the five-track playlist.
These twists and turns and mood changes, and we go through such an enormous range of emotions.
The new series of Add to Playlist on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
With me, Anna Phoebe.
And me, Jeffrey Guacci.
Starts this evening at 7:15.
To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
In the next half an hour, the US has been using a strategy of maximum pressure on Cuba. Will it inevitably lead to military conflict? And Jess Phillips, former Minister for Women and Girls, is going to be joining us at around about 10 to 8 to talk about how we tackle misogyny among teenagers.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Katia Adler. It's 28 minutes to 8. Time for a summary of the news with Lisa Costello.
The Green Party says social media posts shared by its former candidate in the Makerfield by-election, which described the attack on Jewish ambulances in North London as a false flag, don't reflect the views of the party. Chris Kennedy was announced as the Green candidate yesterday, but withdrew hours later, citing personal and family reasons. The Green Party said Mr. Kennedy told them he had deleted the posts and apologised for any offence caused. Government borrowing rose by a quarter in April to £24.3 billion. That's £4.9 billion more than at the same point last year and higher than forecast. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has warned Cuba that the likelihood of a negotiated peace settlement isn't high, and he said the country posed a threat to America's national security. Yesterday, Washington charged Cuba's former president, Raul Castro, with murder over the 1996 downing of two planes which killed US nationals. Mr. Rubio made the comments before boarding a flight to Sweden, where foreign ministers are gathering for a NATO summit. He said President Trump was very disappointed at NATO members, accusing them of failing to support the US with its conflict in Iran. Detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office have made a fresh appeal for information from the public. It's understood detectives are concerned that potential witnesses might think they're focusing only on the allegation that the former prince leaked confidential government files to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, when their inquiry is wider than that. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied wrongdoing in relation to his association with Epstein and has denied any personal gain from his role as a UK trade envoy. Yellow heat alerts for health are due to start in parts of England as temperatures are set to reach 30 Celsius over the bank holiday weekend. The UK Health Security Agency has issued warnings for the Midlands, London and the east and southeast of England.
Lisa, thank you so much. It is 26 minutes to 8. Cuban students, state workers and supporters of the Cuban Revolution will be gathering in Havana later today for a state-organised march in support of its former leader, the 94-year-old Raúl Castro, brother of Fidel. Mr. Castro was charged with murder and other crimes in the United States this week over the shooting down of two US civilian planes in 1996. The Cuban government says the charges against Mr. Castro are political and are a pretext to US military action on the island of Cuba as tension between the old enemies grows. Our correspondent Will Grant reports from Havana.
It is an incident which is burned into the collective memory of Cubans and Cuban Americans of both Havana and Miami. In 1996, these were the radio communications between the control tower and two Cuban MiG fighter jets shortly before they shot down two US civilian aircraft, killing all four people on board. Whether it took place over international or Cuban waters remains a point of dispute.
Nations and their leaders cannot be permitted to target Americans.
The aircraft belonged to a Florida-based group called Brothers to the Rescue, which would drop emergency supplies to Cuban migrants trying to reach the US by sea and alert the Coast Guard to any vessel in difficulty. However, the group also dropped propaganda leaflets over Havana and had been repeatedly warned against violating Cuban airspace.
The United States government has not forgotten these innocent men who were shot out of the sky.
Now, 30 years on, charges of murder and conspiracy to murder US citizens have been brought against Raul Castro, the then defense minister and second in command to his late brother Fidel. The Cuban military pilots that day were also indicted. In Havana itself, the decision has been greeted with both bemusement and concern. I visited a construction site at a place called Barrio Toledo, where the Cuban state is trying to tackle the island's acute social housing crisis by building homes out of repurposed shipping containers. Critics say the container homes will be unbearably hot in Cuba's stifling summer temperatures, but officials insist they're a smart and practical solution.
If I take a walk in one, it is essentially a shipping container with the front ripped off. Two windows at the back, four at the front. A novel way to deal with Havana's housing crisis. Still, for many families, it is far better than their current circumstances, which have been made even more dire by the now five-month-long US fuel blockade.
Estos contenedores llegan aquí a Cuba.
The project's foreman is a committed revolutionary called Orlando Diaz, I asked him if he thought the charges against Raul Castro were a precursor to military action. The charges against Raul are a vile lie, he said, echoing the government's position. Orlando is well aware of what happened in Venezuela earlier this year when Nicolas Maduro was forcibly removed from power by US troops. But he's convinced that if the Trump administration is building towards the use of force in Cuba, the outcome will be very different.
Venezuela es Venezuela, pero Cuba es Cuba.
Venezuela is Venezuela and Cuba is Cuba, he said. And here we don't lack the courage for this moment.
En un día como hoy, en 1902, la bandera cubana ondeó por primera vez.
Shortly before the charges were filed against Raul Castro, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio delivered a message in Spanish to the Cuban people. President Trump, he said, was offering a new path between the U.S. and a new Cuba, meaning one in which the commercial wing of the military would not control the economy. The last time Raul Castro was seen in public was the Workers' Day celebrations on the 1st of May. The 94-year-old former president stood next to his hand-picked successor, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who has called the charges against Mr. Castro a political manoeuvre to justify the folly of a military aggression against Cuba. With the two sides believed to be far apart in any negotiations, most Cubans wonder where the island will be by next week or next month, let alone by the time the next May Day march comes round.
Well, that was Will Grant reporting from Havana. And a short time ago, I spoke to Lillian Guerra. She is the director of the Cuba program at the University of Florida. And I started by asking her what President Trump wants to achieve in Cuba.
Well, I think Donald Trump has as an end game the idea that he will somehow reproduce the monumental shift that he assumes Ronald Reagan was responsible for in a different way. So he's saying, well, Ronald Reagan won the Cold War and I will liberate Cuba. I think Marco Rubio has a different vision, which he may be hoping to actualize through Donald Trump. And it's a more complex vision. But either way, we have a very difficult and very challenging possibility of military intervention in Cuba.
There's an interpretation of American foreign policy going back decades which says this is all about money, and the money is often manifested in oil. People say, look at Venezuela, look at Iran. But when it comes to Cuba, is this one about money, or is it, as you suggest, about something rather different?
No, it's very different. It's about power. And the reality that in Cuba, the United States had exerted a great degree of its power. And that was, of course, completely eliminated, in part because there was a very popular revolutionary movement that toppled an American-backed dictator named Fulgencio Batista in 1959. And in fact, you know, the United States government was opposed to, the provisional government took power in that moment, and then even more subject to kind of a radicalization that nobody expected for Fidel Castro. And that took place in 1960, at really the end of 1960, nationalized U.S. businesses. So the United States no longer either welcome or really present in Cuba. And that really changed the game.
The central claims made by the Trump administration are that Cuba is a failing or failed state, that it's a state sponsor of terrorism, and it therefore actually poses a threat to American citizens. How much of that is true?
Well, I think that's a pretty weak actual position. The reality is that the United States would like to reverse its own history in Cuba by kind of rewriting it. And that would entail somehow taking Cuba back. And right now, the Trump administration is really exploiting the deep, deep, deep poverty in which the Cuban government has positioned the Cuban people. And the Cuban people are desperate for change. And so it's Trump trying to exploit that.
There's a particular shortage of food and blackouts at the moment as well, aren't there? Things have gotten very markedly worse in recent days. What are the prospects of an internal coup?
Well, I think they might be good because, frankly, the alternative would be that the Cuban government would stick to its hard line and then in response receive a sort of wild card from Trump, which would be a kind of surgical strike to take out Raul Castro ostensibly, extracting from Cuba, and then put into force this warrant for his arrest and the indictment that came down yesterday.
What are the chances, if that doesn't happen, of the US actually achieving regime change? A lot of these leaders actually live underground, don't they?
Right. I think the biggest problem that we have in terms of just pragmatics is that in times like these, the Cuban government has already developed a far advanced system of underground tunnels in which most of their top brass resides. And we have places that are really peopled above ground by residential neighborhoods. So I think whatever plans the U.S. military has for surgical strikes, there would be inevitably civilian consequences. That would play into the hands of the Cuban government's own narrative of self-victimization at the hands of the U.S. imperialists.
Lillian Guerra, thank you so much for joining us.
It's just gone 17 minutes to 8.
33 degrees. That's what Simon King said about the prospects for Monday in some parts of England. It's a bank holiday, of course. Half term is getting underway, and with a heatwave promised, come traffic jams and rail strikes and closures that could mean millions of travellers face disruption. The port of Dover is currently reporting a wait of an hour to get through border controls. It's the first holiday period since the EU's new border system was fully implemented. And at times like this, the one man that we often dial up, because he's usually somewhere rather busy, is Simon Calder, the travel correspondent of The Independent, who I think, Simon, this morning is at a pretty loud King's Cross station. Can you hear us, Simon?
Good morning. Yes, I can, Amol. And this is one of the many locations across the country which is going to see serious disruption because of rail closures for network rail engineering projects. So from tomorrow until close of play on Monday, there will not be any trains going direct from here to Newcastle and into Scotland. If you happen to run a rail replacement bus operation, then probably this weekend you think it's Christmas because there is so much disruption. Looking across to the west, the main link from London via Bristol to Cardiff and Swansea through the Severn Tunnel is going to be closed. So lots of rail replacement buses from Bristol to Newport. And that is actually going to continue not just through the bank holiday weekend, but right through up to the 9th, the 8th of June. So large amounts of disruption on the trains, which is, I'm afraid, only going to put more traffic on the roads.
Goodness. And also there's disruption, I read, with the main route between Leeds and Manchester, which goes through Huddersfield. There's upgrade work on there, so that's going to be disrupted as well. Any prospects for the roads being any better? I mean, what do we know about the congestion that's forecast for this afternoon, Simon?
Right. OK, well, the worst jams this weekend actually start as early as this afternoon, and the M25 anti-clockwise is going to see the heaviest traffic around about tea time today, because you will get people on their getaway journeys mixing with normal commuters and business traffic. Then, of course, there's a problem of rail strikes, because today and tomorrow, London North Western Railway and West Midlands Railway are both running a very reduced operation. Saturday is going to be very busy, particularly if you are heading along with the half-term crowds to the seaside towns, particularly in the southwest, and also places like Blackpool and the Lake District on the M6. Now, normally, the Sunday in the middle of a bank holiday weekend is relatively quiet. However, that is not going to be happening this coming Sunday, partly because, as Simon King reported, it's going to be lovely and we do like to be beside the seaside, but also because it's the final day of the Premier League.
Oh, yes.
All the matches kick off at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you'll have hundreds and thousands of football fans on the move. And for instance, Brighton is at home to Manchester United on exactly the day that many of us would like to be in Brighton. Nottingham Forest hosts Bournemouth. Then from London, you've got Fulham at home to Newcastle, Sunderland welcoming, if that's the right word, Chelsea. And these are long journeys with no sensible rail alternative because of the engineering works. Add to that a couple of London Merseyside matches, Spurs home to Everton, Liverpool hosting Brentford, and there's an awful lot of people on the move for football, and that is going, I'm afraid, to coalesce, if that's the best term, with all the people who are heading out for the day simply because they've decided, well, it's too tricky to go abroad, what with all the entry-exit system nonsense.
Jolly good. Simon, got a busy morning ahead. I would say you've got a train to catch, but maybe you haven't. It's always good to talk to you. Simon Calder in King's Cross. Thank you very much indeed.
13 minutes to 8 in just a few moments after three teenagers avoid jail for 11 counts of rape. We'll be examining what can be done to tackle misogyny in young men with the minister in charge of safeguarding until just last week, Jess Phillips. But it's time now for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London.
Good morning. I don't really follow football, but this past week there seemed to be a lot of it in the news. One of the most contentious stories has been that of Southampton, who admitted to spying on their opponents' training sessions. They've now lost their appeal against expulsion from the Championship playoffs, which they described as manifestly disproportionate. And for many of the fans who were hurt, it may seem like an unfair and collective punishment. But while the fallout has been enormous, the issue isn't really about the consequences for breaking a rule. Football survives mistakes, controversies, and questionable refereeing decisions every week. What it can't survive is the erosion of trust. Once clubs begin believing covert spying and deception are acceptable routes to competitive advantage, the integrity of the sport itself starts to erode. Competition in all areas of life must still have moral boundaries, because if winning becomes the only value left, then every other principle gradually becomes negotiable. Whether in football, politics, business, or our relationships, a culture obsessed purely with outcomes eventually loses the moral language needed to restrain itself. Success begins to justify deception, and eventually people no longer even recognize dishonesty, because it's become so normalized by success. But if restraint is important, so is the principle of proportionality. The Quran reminds us, "We have made you a middle nation," a verse which inspired Muslim thinkers to see balance and equilibrium as a spiritual act. A small wound shouldn't become a lifelong bitterness. A mistake shouldn't lead to total exile, and justice should always be distinguishable from revenge. This isn't weakness. It's God consciousness, contained in the sacred words, "By justice the heavens and the earth endure." When so much of our culture encourages us towards extremes, cutting people off, destroying people's reputations, the courage to remain fair, even when you're hurting or angry, is a difficult but necessary virtue. On losing their appeal, Southampton apologised to their fans and supporters, stating that trust now needs to be rebuilt and that they were determined to put things right. And in the end, that is all any of us can hope to do, in sport or in life in general. All of us carry a relationship we could mend, a trust we can uphold. And while it's not easy, perhaps one of the quietest forms of spiritual maturity is the ability to put something right before time makes a repair impossible.
That was Thought for the Day with Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London. Brings us to 10 to 8.
Three teenage boys sentenced on 11 counts of rape have been given non-custodial sentences. Not sending them to jail is far too lenient, according to a police chief. The boys filmed on their phones as they raped two teenage girls in two separate attacks. The footage shows the boys laughing and encouraging each other, and they shared the videos on social media. The case has again raised questions about misogynistic attitudes amongst some young men, with the Crown Prosecution Service saying it's vital that young people are educated and informed about consent. Well, joining me now is Jess Phillips, former Minister for Safeguarding and Women and Girls. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the boys got youth rehabilitation orders, a restraining order for 10 years not to contact their victims. They avoided jail. The judge said he wanted to support the boys' reintegration into society. I'm keen to get to you on these bigger issues, but as for this sentence, you say it's not good enough.
Yeah, it seems unduly lenient to me, and has wider public interest beyond just the case itself. in the message, I think, that it sends. And look, while we can all agree that rehabilitation is vital, you should be able to be rehabilitated within our youth estate. And those young women going through a rape trial like this will not have been a simple thing to do. It will have been many, many months, if not years, to achieve any sort of justice. And I'm afraid to say, I think it sends a bad message.
Well, of course, the government data shows that, you know, there's a reoffending rate for children. About a third go on to reoffend, according to the figures. So, you know, going to jail isn't always the answer. But I was saying that, you know, the Crown Prosecution Service, also the police in recent months, have warned about rising numbers of rapes among teens. They want a bigger effort to tackle misogynistic attitudes. Why isn't that culture change happening? You've spoken so often about it.
Mm-hmm. Look, there is a number of things. So first and foremost, I was part of writing the Violence Against Women and Girls Strategy for Government, which is exactly about that culture change, about looking for prevention, so that when these boys or other young people show signs of sexually harmful behaviours, we need to have interventions, as we would with knife crime, as we have with extremism within our schools. It just simply does not exist for misogyny and sexually harmful behaviours.
You talked about it, though, back in December. You said there was going to be an effort in schools, you know, a drive to tackle misogyny in schools. So what happened to that?
It's happening, but the truth is that when we talk about women and girls' lives, it's just wallpaper. And so actually, we don't know what works in this space. So the government was, what I had set about doing was investing in the research into exactly what programmes would work, rather than just saying, oh, we'll just do something because we're being called on to do something. We have to think about the long term. But look, I'm not necessarily here to represent the government. I'm not sure that they would particularly pleased for me to do that. But the truth is that for about 10 years, we have allowed young people to essentially be, especially young boys, to be experimented on by social media companies. And in this case, these young people were essentially, it seems, raping for content in order to put it onto social media, share it amongst their friends, gloating about raping these poor young women. And very, very little has been done in the last decade to see what effect violent pornography and the rise of terrible influences online has had on young people. And it is, unfortunately, these young women who've paid the price. So that absolutely has to be done. But it's going to take time to work out what actually works. You can't just go overnight and go, oh, this is the programme that will work. You need to look at what actually works and then undertake that. Well, and we should ban social media for under 16s.
So social media platforms say they are working to make it safer, for example. You could also say that young men and men in general, I mean, most people have access to social media. Not everybody takes it to these kind of actions. But in your resignation letter to the Prime Minister last week, you criticised the slow workings of the number 10 machine. You said it took you over a year to get the government even to threaten to legislate on stopping children being able to take naked images of themselves. Do you think the government failing to act is putting children at risk?
Look, do I think that that should have been done quicker? Absolutely. Do you know that social media companies could do it overnight? They could do the thing that I want to happen without any legislation. So the idea that they are doing what they need to do is, I have to say, absolute fallacy. But look, do I think that we should have been acting faster on all of these things? Absolutely, of course we should have, which is why I resigned. And if the young people involved in this had not had the capability to take intimate images of each other, which is what I have been proposing, and I very much hope the government will now act on, this content would never have been able to have been made. They wouldn't have had the capability on their phones to do it.
So you're saying the government's failure to act is putting children's lives and safety at risk?
But well, of course, if there is something, but To be perfectly honest, the government, even if we legislated to do this, it would still take time. Legislation takes time. Social media could do this today.
Sorry to move on, but given your commitment to the protection of women and girls, why didn't you resign over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as US ambassador? Now, he is a man who associated with the known sex offender Jeffrey Epstein well after his conviction. So why not go then?
The reason was because I threatened to go. As I said in my letter, every single time the Peter Mandelson story came up, I threatened to go. And in fact, what I did was I used those crises to move forward. The half of the violence against women and girls strategy was written and made better on the back of the fact that I was threatening to resign over Peter Mandelson. Now, that doesn't fill me with joy, but I will do anything I can to advance the cause of women and girls. And never
harder outside government.
I changed a huge amount around women and girls when I was in opposition. So actually, there's no reason why I cannot keep doing this work. And actually, I think that using this opportunity today to ask the families of the girls in this case and the girls themselves to get in touch with me to see what I can do to help them with regard to what I believe to be an unduly lenient sentence. I don't like to act on victims' behalf without their consent.
Jess Phillips, former Minister for Safeguarding and Women and Girls, thank you.
It is 8:03, and here to tell us what is going to be, well, not quite here, but somewhere, to tell us what's going to be on this evening's Any Questions, it's Alex Forsyth. Where are you, Alex?
Hello, morning, Amal. Well, tonight we will be in Warminster, which is a market town on the edge of Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire. And while politics might feel a little calmer than it did last week, there's still plenty our audience might want to discuss. So to take their questions, we have the chair of the Labour Growth Group of MPs, Chris Curtis. Damien Hines is a Conservative MP and former Education Secretary. Mariella Frostrup is a journalist, broadcaster and campaigner. And Mark Littlewood is the Director of Popular Conservatism, or PopCon for short. We will be live at 8 p.m. Hope you can join us.
Thanks, Alex. It's 8:02. Time for a weather forecast with Simon.
Thanks, Katia. Well, today is going to be the first day of the really warm weather that's going to come as we head through the bank holiday weekend. By Monday, we could see the warmest May day on record as temperatures approach 33 degrees. Of course, it is a very early heat wave, this. We're still technically in spring. But across England and Wales, for most, it's going to be a sunny day. There is going to be a little bit more cloud around parts of northwest England, later into North Wales, but more so in West Wales, the far southwest of England. Cloud be a little bit more stubborn to clear here, maybe even the odd spot of rain around West Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly. So where you keep the cloud, temperatures would be about 15 to 18 degrees, but elsewhere, widely temperatures into the 20s, highest towards the southeast, of course, where we could see 25 to 28, perhaps 29 or even 30 degrees around Cambridgeshire. Across Northern Ireland and Scotland, here it's cloudier. We're going to see some rain affecting northern and western areas of Scotland. It'll stay cloudy into the afternoon. Some brighter skies, perhaps in eastern parts of Scotland, but temperatures here 19 to 22. Elsewhere, looking at highs typically 17 to 19, but much cooler in the far northwest with only about 13 or 14 Celsius.
Thanks, Simon. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Katia Adler and Amol Rajan.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 22nd of May. Good morning. The headlines. Government borrowing rose more than expected last month. We'll speak to the business secretary, Peter Kyle, at 8:20. Detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten Windsor have made a new appeal for people to come forward with information. And a man who quit as the Green Party candidate in the Makerfield by-election yesterday has apologised for social media posts he shared about an attack on Jewish ambulances in London.
Also coming up in the next hour, what are the practical realities of implementing the new guidance on single-sex spaces? The chair of the EHRC, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, will join us at 8:10. We'll hear from services, businesses and people impacted by the changes.
How are you going to police it? That's all down to appearance and stereotypes, which is what the guidance then tries to condemn, that we shouldn't create stereotypes around people.
Should work experience be mandatory for the over 16s? The UK boss of Amazon thinks so, but will it make a difference to workforce challenges? We discuss that at 8:20. And with a new novel on the horizon, Hamnet screenwriter Maggie O'Farrell takes us inside her hefty awards cabinet.
This is the BAFTA, and that's the Golden Globe. It's really
heavy, is it?
Somebody handed it to me on stage and I really nearly dropped it on Steven Spielberg's foot. Can you imagine?
The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Government borrowing increased by more than expected last month, according to official figures. The Office for National Statistics says the difference between public sector spending and tax income was £24.3 billion. That's 25% higher than in April last year. Our business correspondent Mark Ashdown reports.
The government spends more on funding public services and debt than it receives in taxes, so it borrows money to make up the difference. For the month of April, the government borrowed £5 billion more than in April last year, which was substantially higher than the official forecast. The Office for National Statistics said an increase in tax receipts was more than offset by higher spending on benefits and other costs. Borrowing for the latest full financial year was revised down, however, and on a comparable basis remains the lowest since the year ending March 2020. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Lucy Rigby, said the government's economic plan was cutting borrowing and debt, and said that working families would benefit from falls in inflation and cuts to interest rates.
Detectives investigating Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office have repeated their call for people to come forward with information. It's understood detectives are concerned that potential witnesses might think they're focusing only on the allegation that the former prince shared a confidential trade report with Jeffrey Epstein. Here's our UK correspondent, Daniel Sanford.
It was in February that Thames Valley Police detectives made the decision to arrest Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office. He was released under investigation later that day. The initial allegation arose out of the publicly released Epstein files and concerned the alleged leaking of government reports to Jeffrey Epstein. Today, detectives are making a fresh appeal for information and are stressing that their investigation is examining a number of aspects of alleged misconduct. It's understood that detectives don't want the public to think they're only interested in alleged leaks of confidential government files. Misconduct in public office is a very complex offence, which potentially can include a wide range of behaviour, including abuse of position, sexual misconduct and corruption, amongst other things. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor has consistently denied wrongdoing in relation to his association with Epstein and has denied any personal gain from his role as a UK trade envoy.
The Green Party says its former candidate in the Makerfield by-election has apologised for sharing social media posts that described the attack on Jewish ambulances in North London as a false flag. Chris Kennedy withdrew his candidacy yesterday, citing personal and family reasons, just hours after the party had announced him. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
When Chris Kennedy, a registered nurse and children's safeguarding specialist, was unveiled as the Green candidate in the upcoming Makerfield by-election yesterday morning, the party's leader, Zach Polanski, said he would make a fantastic representative for the area. But just a few hours later, he withdrew from the race. The party still insists that was for personal and family reasons. But last night, the Times newspaper reported that Mr. Kennedy had shared social media posts which described an attack on Jewish community ambulances in North London earlier this year as a false flag, a term which usually means staged. A spokesperson said the posts didn't reflect the views of the Green Party. They said they had spoken to Mr. Kennedy about the posts and said he had deleted them and apologised for any offence caused.
A full list of candidates in the Makerfield by-election is available on the BBC News website. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Cuba as a threat to US national security and warned that the chances of a peaceful agreement with the Caribbean nation are not high. Washington has been ramping up pressure on the communist government in Havana, including by charging Cuba's former president, Raúl Castro, over the shooting down of two planes in 1996. From Washington, here's our correspondent Joel Gunter.
Trump administration officials have previously alluded to the possibility of military action against Cuba, but Marco Rubio's latest remarks will take on added weight after the murder charges leveled against Raúl Castro. Casting doubt on a diplomatic outcome, Mr. Rubio said the Trump administration was both very serious and very focused on changing the Cuban regime. His comments follow a build-up of U.S. military might in the region, with the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier and three escort warships arriving in the Caribbean Sea in recent days. Cuba's foreign minister yesterday denied that the country posed a threat to the U.S., saying the accusation was a pretext for U.S. aggression.
Mr. Rubio has now flown to Sweden for a meeting of NATO foreign ministers. Before he boarded the flight, he said President Trump was very upset with members of the Defence Alliance for going into hiding during the Iran war. It's expected Mr. Rubio will use the gathering to press for burden sharing between Washington's NATO partners. Parents of some of the children injured in the Southport knife attack say they believe they've received insufficient support because of the anonymity given to them by the courts. They've told the BBC they feel their daughters' experiences have been erased from the public's understanding of the case. They've been speaking to our special correspondent, Judith Moritz.
23 girls survived the attack at a Taylor Swift-themed dance and yoga class in July 2024. The parents of five of those who were stabbed have spoken to the BBC. Some parents said their daughters had missed out on support from local authorities after officials told them they didn't know who their children were. All said they felt their daughters were being forgotten. The court order, which prevents the media from identifying the injured children, was imposed in August 2024. The children's parents say it's a means of protecting their daughters' privacy as they grow up, but they also feel it's rendered them invisible. Sefton and Lancashire councils said they continue to provide support for those affected by the attack and have coordinated with a range of agencies.
The boss of Amazon UK has said he believes work experience should be mandatory for over 16s. The company employs 75,000 people in this country, but John Bumphrey said Amazon struggled to find workers with the skills it needs. He told the BBC work experience was the most transformative thing he had seen.
It could just be a week. If you get a T-level student and they come in for a week, they understand the value of teamwork, of communication, of problem solving, things that I don't think we teach in our curriculum, but that all employers are looking for.
Yellow heat health alerts are due to come into force across some English regions this morning as parts of the UK prepare for a bank holiday heatwave. Record-breaking May temperatures are possible over the next few days, as BBC Weather's Ben Rich reports.
The Midlands, London, East Anglia and the South East are covered by this heat health alert issued by the UK Health Security Agency, which is in force from today until next Wednesday. It warns high temperatures could have minor impacts on health services and put vulnerable people at risk. Parts of England and Wales will see the thermometer climbing into the low 30s over the weekend, with some places likely to reach official heatwave criteria. It's even possible that the UK's May temperature record of 32.8 Celsius could be broken. Scotland and Northern Ireland will be a little cooler, but some areas could still approach the mid-20s.
The number of new melanoma skin cancer cases in the UK has risen above 20,000 in a year for the first time. The charity Cancer Research UK says too much exposure to ultraviolet light from the sun or sunbeds is part of the cause. It says an estimated 9 out of every 10 cases are avoidable. Lily Allen has received the Outstanding Song Collection Prize at the 71st Ivor Novello Awards, which celebrate excellence in songwriting and music composition. Sam Fender won Songwriter of the Year. George Michael was posthumously awarded a Fellowship of the Ivors Academy, as was the Radiohead frontman Tom York. And there was a special honour for Sir Elton John, as our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson reports from the ceremony in London.
Sir Elton John has a new job. He was the surprise guest as it was announced that he is to become the first ever president of the Ivors Academy, the organisation which formed in 1944 to represent songwriters. The plan is that he will use the role to advocate for the rights of musical creatives, and on stage he made it clear it is a subject he is passionate about.
Creativity, when you're writing music or writing a song, is probably the greatest thing you can ever have. Music is the greatest gift you can possibly be given.
Other winners included the Irish singer CMAT for Album of the Year. The Scottish indie folk singer Jacob Alon picked up two awards, including the Rising Star. And Sam Fender was named Songwriter of the Year.
Colin Patterson reporting.
Lisa, thank you so much. It is 8:10. When in April last year, the UK Supreme Court ruled that under the Equality Act, the term woman refers to biological sex, that is, someone who is female at birth, it left unclear the answer to any number of practical questions about how this matter should be enforced. A year on, the Equality and Human Rights Commission has provided new guidance this morning for those practicalities. It confirms that single-sex spaces should be used on the basis of biological sex rather than gender identity. And we'll explore what that means in just a moment. But first, some important caveats. Number one, this guidance is not the law. The law is the law, and the relevant law here is the Equality Act on which the Supreme Court ruled. Number two, this guidance applies to services, public functions and associations. So it applies to places like shopping centres, gyms, hospitals and restaurants. It is not guidance for employers. We await that. And number three, lots of people who run services, public functions and associations do still have questions, and they have 40 days to raise concerns. After that, this guidance becomes statutory. Jess Harvey is a GP in Shropshire and said the guidelines will be difficult to enforce in some GP surgeries.
Essentially, there isn't additional space for us to put additional toilets in. And I think from our point of view, is what we really need is just some clarity that this isn't going to be something that we're going to be judged on in something like our CQC inspections, when actually it's an unachievable target, really. We always want to be trying to meet all of the needs of our patients. And I would hate for this to be something where patients felt that we weren't meeting their needs in terms of providing that inclusive space for everybody.
Well, thank you to Dr. Harvey in Shropshire for that. We'll come back to that thought in just a moment. Here's Kate Nichols. She's the chair of UK Hospitality, and she explained how businesses in her industry will interpret the guidance.
It's about making sure that when we're looking at implementation, we do it in a pragmatic way. Businesses will need time to adapt to make sure that they get this right. And in some small cases, that will mean adaptation of their facilities, and they need time to do that. The areas that are cause uncertainty are small pubs, restaurants, where they might have a gents loo, a ladies loo, and there isn't a third space. So we need to be able to work through that practically.
Questions, of course, for the regulator, and Mary-Ann Stevenson from the EHRC has joined us in the studio very kindly. We'll speak to her in just a moment. Before that, there have also been questions, of course, from the trans community too. Helen Bircher is the chair of the organisation Transactional and a trans woman.
I would like to know how denying that I'm a woman is showing me respect or enabling me to keep my dignity. I think the second that I would like to ask Mary-Ann is, what steps have been taken to advance trans people's rights in the last 5 years, while the EHRC has been trying to implement an unworkable and unjust bathroom ban that the UK itself condemned back in 2016? I think importantly, how is this going to be enforced in anything other than a haphazard way? At Transactual, we already know that challenges and violence against gender non-conforming people is up. And so is this not just a bully's charter? I think the guidance is completely unworkable. How are you going to police it? That's all down to appearance and stereotypes, which is what the guidance then tries to condemn, that we shouldn't create stereotypes around people.
Well, Mary-Ann Stevenson, the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, has come into the studio to join us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being here on what is a very, very busy morning for you. So for more than a year, ministers have said to us and others that we need to wait for the arrival of this guidance. You've published it now. How does this guidance take us forward?
So the guidance, as you said, covers services, associations and public functions, and it explains how those can meet their responsibilities under the Equality Act, which protects all of us against discrimination, harassment and victimisation. We started work on updating it before the Supreme Court judgment, and then following the Supreme Court judgment, which, as you say, said that sex in the Equality Act meant biological sex, we revisited those sections and updated it. It is not law. We don't make the law. Parliament makes the law. The courts decide it. Our job is simply to provide guidance to help people understand how they can follow the law.
Well, let's try and do that now. So to be really clear, is there a legal requirement on all associations, so gyms, restaurants, shopping malls, is there a legal requirement on all of them in this country to provide an option for trans people who don't want to use toilets designated for biological sex?
What there is a situation where you both have the right to provide single-sex services, and in some cases not providing them might amount to discrimination against women. Trans people also have the right not to be discriminated against, and so there may be situations where failing to provide a service to them might amount to discrimination. But we have to take a common sense and proportionate response to this. So what we've done in the code is come up with a number of different suggestions for how, you know, organisations of different sizes can do this. So, for example, if you're a shopping centre and you're remodelling your toilets, you might want to consider having both single-sex and some unisex toilets in there. If you are a small community centre and you can't do that, you might decide to make the an accessible toilet, which is already a unisex space and is often used, for example, by parents as a baby change facility as well. You might choose to make that open to a wider group of people. But how you do it will depend on the circumstances.
But do they all need to be doing it? That's the thing. I mean, it's because most people aren't remodelling their toilets, and most people in this country are extremely skint, especially at the moment. If there's a cricket club in Lancashire or there's a small restaurant in Ipswich, right now, listening to this programme and thinking, so we've been around for decades or maybe a century, we've got two toilets, one was for women, one was for men. Do they need to be listening to you and looking at this guidance thinking, we need to act here because we're under a legal, as well as maybe moral, duty to provide that safe space for trans people?
So what you've got is a situation where people have protection against discrimination. And that, for example, might include disabled people who are also entitled to accessible toilets. What you have to do in response to that is proportionate. So what, you know, what you're expected to do will depend on your resources, will depend on what's possible in the building. Some things aren't possible in some buildings. So this, I mean, proportionality is a key element of the Equality Act. And I think the important thing is to think more broadly, which is about how can we ensure everybody has access to the services they need. So at the moment, for example, 8 million disabled people report that they're not able to access accessible facilities when they need them. And how you respond to that varies. We've recently done work with the festival organisers Live Nation, for example, on disability access. That involved them spending some money, but the advantage of that was that disabled customers were able to attend festivals that they weren't able to attend in the past.
Sure. One can see why thinking about it more broadly in terms of how we make sure people feel included is something that the boss of the EHRC might want to think a lot about. But I'm just thinking about people who are in charge of associations right now thinking, what do I need to do? And a lot of people might be listening to this and thinking that in very practical ways they are on the wrong side of the law and open and vulnerable to the charge that they're discriminate against trans people when they don't mean to do that.
So, I mean, one thing to be clear about, associations are different in terms of what they need to do from services. Sure. And there's different rules for them. But for services, what you need to do is think about the needs of all your potential customers. Think about whether providing single-sex services is something that's a proportionate means of meeting a legitimate aim. For many small service providers, for example, if you have two self-enclosed cubicles with a sink in, one labelled male, one labelled female, you could make them both unisex. Lots of small cafes, that's what they do already. So, you know, there are different practical solutions that different providers will make. What the code does is explain what the law is so they can know
how to avoid
discrimination.
They need to be thinking about that right now up and down the country. Who enforces this?
So we, as a regulator, are responsible for enforcing the Equality Act. Obviously, individuals also have the ability to take cases to court, and you are seeing a lot of cases going through the courts. So one of the reasons why service providers need to think about this is to avoid the costs of litigation. And the way we enforce this in terms of the way we enforce the whole of the Equality Act and the Human Rights Act, which we're also responsible for, is, you know, we're a small organisation. We have to take a kind of strategic approach to intervention. And most often that is done by trying to work with organisations to help them improve what they're doing.
Sure, but it's very striking. The original submission detailed how service providers should consider whether users might have, and I quote, a reasonable objection to the presence of transgender people. The final text introduces a slightly more rigorous test and said that such decisions should be made only on a case-by-case basis, after evaluating the extent to which the trans person presents.
No, that is a specific thing. So one of the things that the Supreme Court said is that there are very, very small minority of cases where trans people can be prevented from using the services for their own sex. And I would stress that this is a small number of cases. You might think, for example, of a trans man who is legally female under the Equality Act, who is taking testosterone but wants to compete in competitive, take part in sport, for example, and a sporting association might decide that actually, because of the testosterone, that would make a difference to their competitiveness. More generally, if you have a single-sex service, the decision is, you know, once you've made a decision to have a single-sex service and that is a proportionate means of meeting a legitimate aim, that's does not you don't make decisions there on a case-by-case basis. That is a straightforward situation where the service is male-only or female-only. It's got nothing to do with appearance. It's to do with people's sex.
Why is this guidance taking so long to materialise?
Well, we first produced draft guidance last year before the Supreme Court judgment. There was then the Supreme Court judgment. It had to be revisited. We had to consult again on that. We submitted it to government in September. They have had to consider it.
It's a long time. I mean, a lot of people would say that this kind of gives a regulatory expression and confirmation of something the Supreme Court ruled on. It's taken nearly 14 months. I mean, some people say
we're very aware that service providers have been very keen to get this guidance as soon as possible.
And employers now, because one of your predecessor, Kishwa Faulkner, who's a former boss of the EHRC, said something very striking. She said the main question for the EHRC and the government now is how long it's going to take to produce guidance for employers. This code doesn't cover employment law. And I think what she's getting at there is if it's taken 14 months to provide this guidance for services and associations, it might be quite a long time for employers, there are rather a lot.
The thing about this particular code of practice is once it's been laid before Parliament, it becomes statutory. There is a particular process you have to go through that. We produce guidance and advice all the time that doesn't have to go through this process.
So when can employers expect
that? And so that is something that we will be looking at. We will be talking to the Health and Safety Executive because they're the regulator responsible for the Health and Safety at Work Act, but obviously that intersects with the Equality Act.
Okay.
But in the meantime, the law is still the law. So employers, as with service providers, have to be taking action now, have to be looking at their legal obligations. And the Supreme Court judgment is very, very clear. Where you are providing a single-sex service, that has to be on the basis of biological sex.
Mary-Ann Stevenson, Chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It is 24 minutes past eight. Cheaper theme park tickets and free bus rides were on offer when the Chancellor outlined plans for a summer of fun yesterday. But borrowing figures out this morning point to just how much misery might follow. Government borrowing jumped to a higher than expected £24.3 billion last month. That marks the second highest April level on record. The Office for National Statistics says although the Treasury took in more money, the increase was outweighed by higher spending on benefits and other costs. Well, that would include servicing the government debt. Joining me now is Peter Kyle, Secretary of State for Business and Trade. Good morning.
Good morning, Katya.
Now, we know the Iran war is pushing up borrowing costs. We don't know when the Iran war is going to end. There's also, you know, concern about political volatility here in the UK. So how much worse do you expect borrowing figures to get?
Well, as you can see, this just illustrates the importance of sticking to our fiscal rules and getting the fundamentals right of running the economy. The fact that just this week, as well as in addition to the statistics you've just given, we've risen to the top of the G7 growth rate. We've also had inflation falling. Now, if inflation was higher because of a consequence of the kind of policies we've seen in the past, then this would be, you know, a catastrophic combination. So we are really doubling down to make sure that the interventions we make into the economy are anti-inflationary or certainly make getting a grip on inflation whilst giving support to consumers and to businesses at times of stress. You know, the two other packages I'm announcing today
I'll come to those in just a moment. But, you know, despite what you're saying about the government efforts that are underway, borrowing costs for the UK, they're higher than for the US, for Germany, for Italy. And Italy is often pointed at as a more unstable government and therefore would have higher borrowing costs. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said last month the fiscal rules that you're praising are not working. It says the government needs to take a more holistic approach to fiscal policy.
Yeah, but hang on a sec. Inflation just fallen, growth to the top of the G7. I think you'll find our fiscal rules are having a positive impact on the fundamentals of our economy right now. Now, the cost of borrowing is something that Rachel Rees, the Chancellor, has spoken a great deal about. She has been she is acutely aware that the high borrowing costs of Britain stem back to the mini-budget and the Liz Truss experiment that blew a hole in our finances. And it is very hard, once a country lets loose of our finances in the way that they did then, to get a grip back on our reputation around the world, because, of course, the bond markets are global. They're not just domestic, and they're looking at us compared to other countries, and it takes a long time to get a grip back on the reputation. And that's one of the many things that we're having to pick up the pieces of from the previous administrations.
But you're well in government now, and the International Monetary Fund has said to Rachel Reeves, do make sure that you don't borrow more. But is that going to be possible? I mean, we heard from the Chancellor yesterday the Great British summer measures to give relief to families. The Chief Executive of Citizens Advice, that's Dame Claire Moriarty, she said, OK, those government measures will make a difference. But she said, you know, people coming to them, they're not worrying about August. They're struggling now and they worry that things will only get worse as the winter hits. We didn't hear anything from the Chancellor about support with energy prices. We don't yet know the full extent the Iran war impact will have on the economy. Will it be possible not to borrow more?
Cassio, when I do these interviews, we look at one moment in time at one set of announcements. Look at it in the spirit that the announcements yesterday were made and the context. We've already intervened in energy costs and lowered the costs by £117. Yesterday alone, another announcement to reduce the cost of red diesel so that farmers can have reduced costs, again, having a positive impact on food into the medium and long term. Haulage prices reduced for the price of fuel there. All these interventions we're making in different areas. We made a specific set of announcements about the August experience that families have. We just think that in addition to all of the other interventions that we are making into the economy, that family life is really important. And there is a special moment of the year when kids are on holiday, where parents spend more time with their kids, and we want that experience to be a really good experience. Now, we're not saying that everything is going to be different, but for many families out there, they are going to be able to go to a theme park, a cinema, go to a restaurant, go to the coast,
lovely.
Go to one of the towns,
and it's
and
important.
Have fun in a way that they wouldn't have before.
And that is
a good thing.
When life is difficult. But again, the Institute of Fiscal Studies says actually the benefit to each family from these measures will be around £10. Now, I know you're giving interviews to talk about extra funding to Britain's chemical industry, which you wanted to talk about. You told the Commons that the government is throwing the kitchen sink at cost of living fears. But a parliamentary private secretary, so PPS in your department, resigned last night, saying the government should go in a much bolder direction. The head of the TUC told us today the same thing. They're saying it's good, but not good enough at all.
Katia, they're saying the same things that the Prime Minister is saying, the Chancellor is saying, and I'm saying about being bolder. Now, look at just this week. Just landed a trade deal with the Gulf states, six Gulf states, increasing trade between the two nations by 20%. I've just announced yesterday steps towards taking British Steel into public ownership so that we can give security and resilience to our steel and the people who work in the steel sector. The chemicals and the ceramics package I'm announcing today will not just ensure the future and modernisation of both of those services in the chemical side, that's about national resilience, because we have to think about the supply chains for the domestic economy in a way that we haven't had to think of before. So I'm taking strident action there. But when it comes to ceramics, this is an industry which isn't always, some parts are, but not always, a critical national infrastructure. But when I looked at the communities that depend on the ceramics industry, I am not going to allow that industry to go into decline in the deindustrialised way that the Tories ran the economy in the 80s and see the scarring today. I'm going to intervene to help modernise and support through that modernisation process so that the communities depend on it. These are all big, bold things, Katia.
Well, Peter Kyle, Secretary of State for Business and Trade, thank you for your time this morning.
Mike Williams is big and bold, and he's here at 8:30.
Thank you, Amal. Something a little different this hour, because the curtain comes down this weekend on the domestic football season. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to look back on the last 10 months, from tight title races to FA Cup magic, age-defying managers to animals on the pitch. Here are just some
of the highlights.
The Premier League title race is over!
This was a season of two compelling title races.
It is absolutely astonishing!
In England, after going toe-to-toe with Manchester City, Arsenal finally ended their long 22-year wait for a league title.
Everyone in North London, you can reach fever pitch again!
Mikel Arteta's team were, perhaps unfairly, labelled boring by some. Their 69 goals is the lowest number scored by a Premier League winner in a decade, but they were efficient, utilised set pieces and ground out victories, many of them by 1-0, to consign their bottler tag to, well, the bottle bank.
Look at the streets of London! No club can do it like this! No goal!
Meanwhile, in Scotland, we saw one of the closest title races ever. For months, it looked like the 41-year Old Firm stranglehold would finally be broken.
Hearts are another step closer to history.
Heart of Midlothian were top of the table since September, and on the final day were just moments away from becoming champions for the first time since 1960, only to have the title snatched away from them right at the death. A 14th title in 15 years for Celtic, but surely their most dramatic. At the end of a season that bizarrely saw former manager Martin O'Neill return to Glasgow not once, but twice.
I had a seance last night with Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra. Both were really disappointed because I had made more comebacks than them.
The success of 74-year-old Martin O'Neill was a shot in the arm for older managers. In a season that also saw 77-year-old Neil Warnock return briefly as boss of Torquay and Roy Hodgson back in the dugout at Bristol City at the age of 78.
It's exciting, you know, when you've not been working for a while to get this sort of opportunity.
This was another year where the breathless turnover of managers showed no sign of slowing. Chelsea, Tottenham and Celtic amongst several clubs that had three head coaches in one season. Nottingham Forest went one further with four. Barrow, at the bottom of League Two, had five. Speaking of departures, we're set to say farewell on Sunday to one of the biggest Premier League players of the last decade.
What a splendid goal from Mo Salah!
Mo Salah leaves Liverpool after 9 years and 257 goals. Many, though, expected the Egyptian to walk sooner after saying this in November.
I'm very disappointed. Seems like a club is throwing me under the bus. That's how I feel it.
But Salah wasn't the only one with some explosive post-match thoughts this season.
It's disgusting. They want to ban me? Good, do it. I care about my players and I should be allowed to prepare professionally. You have a look at yourselves first. I know how wrong you are, you cowards.
I'm not sure, even 4 months on, that Swindon manager Ian Holloway's fury at the FA has completely abated. In the Women's Super League, this was the season that Chelsea's six-year dominance finally ended. Instead, the title went up north.
Manchester City, Women's Super League champions.
Their first title in a decade. The WSL will now expand from 12 to 14 teams as the women's game continues its exponential growth. Elsewhere, we should give honourable mentions this season, in no particular order, to Coventry City, back in the Premier League after 25 years, Lincoln City, promoted to the second tier for the first time since 1961, to London City Lionesses, impressing in their debut WSL season, to Aston Villa and Crystal Palace, both excelling in Europe, and to York City, who, alongside Rochdale, served up the most dramatic title race in the history of the National League.
We're going back to the Football League! The promised land is here for York City!
What about the most surprising pitch invader of the season?
Squirrel stops play. We are struggling to get hold of the little fella. Somebody's going to try and catch this squirrel, so...
Something that comes as no surprise, though, is that the most contentious three letters in football continue to divide opinion.
This may be the biggest test for VAR that we have ever seen.
After review, West Ham at number 19.
Expect plenty more VAR chat next season. Meanwhile, I think most people would probably agree that in the third round of the FA Cup, we saw the most romantic moment of the season. A side 14th in the sixth tier, knocking out the holders. Simply the biggest FA Cup shock ever. Let's leave the final word, though, to the famous Hull City squirrel. I wonder if he was ever caught.
He was, and the booze will tell you he's been caught, but I tell you, oh, he's not. He's free again. He's free, and he's roaming around the pitch. He's already scored in both nets. There's cries of sign him up from the Hull City fans. It's still Hull City 1, Bristol City 3, but the squirrel has got 3 now.
Hull City actually named that squirrel player of the match afterwards. That was a highlight for me back in February. So many great memories there, but it is all over as of this weekend. Scottish Cup final live on the iPlayer tomorrow. The final round of Premier League matches on Sunday. You can follow that on BBC Sound. And then we've only got 2.5 weeks to wait until the World Cup. 104 matches this summer to get involved with there.
I love the enthusiasm, Mike. Thank you very much. Here's Lauren Laverne.
My castaway this week is the journalist Gary O'Donoghue, who says the relationship with his audience is what matters most to him.
What I'm trying to do the whole time when I'm broadcasting or writing, you know, I'm trying to give them not just an analysis or the news or whatever, I'm trying to give them a bit of me, because that's how you get them to trust you. They feel they know you.
Gary O'Donoghue, My Castaway. Do join us to hear his Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
I look forward to that. It is 23 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Katia Adler and Amol Rajan. Here is a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
Government borrowing grows to £24.3 billion last month, higher than forecast by the Office for Budget Responsibility. The figure increased by 25% compared to April last year. The Secretary of State for Business and Trade, Peter Kyle, told us the figures showed the importance of the government sticking to its fiscal rules, and he said the UK had risen to the top of the G7 growth chart. Police investigating Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office are making a fresh appeal for information. It's understood that detectives don't want the public to think they're only interested in alleged leaks of confidential government files. The former prince has strenuously and consistently denied any wrongdoing. The Green Party says its former candidate in the Makersfield by-election has apologised for sharing social media posts that describe the attack on Jewish ambulances in North London as a false flag. Chris Kennedy withdrew his candidacy yesterday. The boss of Amazon UK has called for work experience to be mandatory for over 16s. John Bumfrey told the BBC that work experience could be transformative.
Thank you very much, Lisa. It's 22 minutes to 9. And the man who was chair of Ofcom until April, Lord Grade, has written to the Times warning about broadcasters' reliance on reality TV and normal people, and that it risks a line being crossed, the line that separates entertainment from exploitation. This is in the light of the Married at First Sight UK revelations. They were reported by BBC Panorama earlier this week. Two women told the BBC they were raped during the filming of one of the shows. It's one of Channel 4's most successful. A third woman has described an allegation of a non-consensual sex act. Well, I am joined now in the studio by Lord Michael Grade. Good morning to you.
Morning.
So many hats. Former chair of Ofcom until last month. Former chairman of the BBC. That was 2004 to 2006. And you ran Channel 4 for 9 years, 1988 to 1997. So we are talking about the industry. You have got experience under your belt there. Do you think that with reality TV shows, which are hugely popular, and of course people put themselves forward, don't they, to be part of these shows, that they're actually being exploited, maybe you're saying cynically exploited by the industry?
There are different kinds of shows. If you take Traitors, there's no jeopardy, no emotional danger for the contestants at all. If you take some of the other shows at the other end of the extreme, Maths and other things, you worry that they have to put in place so many protocols, so many protections for the members of the public who go on the show, volunteer to go on the show, and they're put into emotional jeopardy. I can only put it that way. And to me, that's a risk you don't take, not in the name of entertainment.
Mm. Is there enough of a vetting process for contestants, you know, to shield the vulnerable. They may put themselves forward and think, you know, I can do it. But,
nothing. Yeah. I understand members of the public make an informed decision to go on these shows. What they don't know and can never know is what they're going to be put through in the name of entertainment on the shows. You know, physical dangers are one thing, health and safety. You know, we can all anticipate where the dangers are. But the emotional dangers of putting people in these, no individual can know what they're getting themselves into. And in the name of what? In the name of ratings and clicks? It's just, we're in danger of going down a very nasty plug hole here.
Well, you say, you know, in the name of what? Married at First Sight UK, the audience figures often top 3 million. I mean, it is a jewel in Channel 4's crown. And they have commissioned a review into welfare on the programme. I mean, you talked about duty of care stipulations. Are there enough on production companies and broadcasters?
No regulations in the world. You can impose more and more regulation. And the more regulations you put in, the more you realise the risk that the programme presents for members of the public. That's the evidence for why this is a watershed moment in my view. You know, you get an old Madame Defarge thought the guillotine was entertainment. She used to sit there knitting. You know, the public will turn up. You could do public executions, and there's a line. These are public service broadcasters. There is a line, and we're really in danger of crossing it. I'm really worried about it.
Yeah, I can see and I can hear that as well. I'm wondering, you can see the temptation that leads broadcasters down this road. They're very popular and they're not always that expensive to make. What could be another format, do you think? Because I suppose the danger is when there's a lot of talk about regulation and stipulation that you know, there will be some who'll say this stifles creativity. What could be an alternative in this watershed moment that you say we're in?
Well, you've just got to use your imagination and be more creatively ambitious rather than reaching down into sort of what I call a below the tabloid level of television, which has never been the tradition of public service broadcasting in this country. And if you do a show like, obviously, Traitors, you know, there's no... I reckon the risk register on that is pretty slim. It's a perfectly wonderful format. The public enjoy taking part in some of these shows and the public enjoy watching them. They don't have to be degrading. They don't have to be gratuitous and they don't have to sink into the gutter.
Can I ask you, Lord Grey, though, do you think that for public broadcasters, they are trying to keep audiences, they're trying to hold on to them? You know, we look even on social media, this idea of clickbait, how do you draw the audiences in? Do you think that's what's taking broadcasters down
the wrong road? There is huge commercial pressure. There's huge commercial pressure. The advertisers need audiences. They're trying to hang on to free-to-air commercial broadcasters are trying to hang on to their advertising share. You've just got to be more creative, more ambitious, take more risks. You know, the great shows...
Risk, but not with individuals.
Not putting the public at risk in ways that they can't begin to understand how they're going to be put at risk. You know, if you do Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, you'll get a big audience. Much more ambitious.
Lord Michael Grade, former chair of Ofcom, and all those other hats, thank you very much.
It's 16 minutes to 9. There is today in our country a quite astonishing social and economic phenomenon concerning young people. The numbers move around a lot, but we have somewhere in the region of 1 million NEETs. That is, 1 million young people aged 16 to 24 who are not in education, employment or training. Young people who often ought perhaps to be in the prime of their lives, certainly physically, but instead are struggling. Why? What can be done to move them from the column of welfare into the column of work, transforming their lives but also making savings and gains that would compound to widespread benefit? What role could that first job, that first step on the ladder have, and are enough young people ready for it? Sean Farrington spoke to John Bountfrey. We've had bits of that interview over the course of this programme. You can also hear it on the Big Boss podcast on BBC Sounds. Bountfrey is the VP and UK country manager for Amazon, the giant retailer, and he told us that students were not being prepared for the world of work.
Our system isn't necessarily producing young people who are ready for work. And the most transformative thing that I've seen that helps young people is work experience. It could just be a week. If you get a T-level student and they come in for a week, they understand the value of teamwork, of communication, of problem solving, things that I don't think we teach in our curriculum, but that all employers are looking for. So I think what we need to do is think about things like, how do we make, should we make work experience mandatory for 16 plus?
Do you think we should?
I think we should. I think we should. I think, as I say, it's the most transformative thing I've seen.
Work experience mandatory for 16 plus. You can hear more from John Bamfrey on the Big Boss interview. Let's turn now to Matt Perry, head teacher of the Halifax Academy, and Shuab Gomote, who's a researcher and policy advisor advising Alan Milburn, who is doing a review of NEETS, former Labour cabinet minister, of course. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm just looking at the pronunciation. Have I got that right? I'm so sorry. Is it Shuabe?
No, it's Shuaib Gamot.
Shuaib Gamot, I'm so sorry. Shuaib Gamot, I'm so sorry about that. Shuaib, would you mind just giving us an overview to begin with of just the context here? How big a problem have we got in this country with NEETS?
Yeah, I mean, you've outlined it really well there, but the scale of this challenge is enormous. Right now, there's nearly a million young people who are not in work, education or employment. Around 14% of 16 to 24-year-olds. That's roughly one in eight young people. And next week, Alan Milburn's interim report will give more insight into why this has become such a national scandal.
Give us a tease. Is that number going up? And if so, why? Why have we got so many young people who are saying they can't work?
I can't give you a tea specifically, but what I can say, I think, is that unless we make significant changes, the number will go up before it goes down.
Okay. We'll come back to what we might do about that and the role of work experience in just a moment. Matt, thank you for joining us from Halifax Academy, probably ahead of a school day. We know you're very busy. Just tell us a bit, if you would, Matt, about the kind of makeup of your school, the kind of demographic background of those who enrol with you.
Good morning. Yeah, we serve quite high community with deprivation. We've got 98.3% ethnic minority. Free school meals is around 37.5%, which is higher than national. And we've got 77% of our learners with EAL. So they've got a lot of challenges around deprivation facing them, our community.
Okay. What would you say, Matt, is the appeal to you of the idea of actually making work experience at 16 mandatory? In other words, it being an absolute requirement that kids at 16 have to do that?
I think the idea is fantastic. I think it would always be around the structures of what that looks like, of how it's done. But I think real life work experience is a really, really fundamentally important thing that young people should be doing to understanding what that looks like. And I think, you know, Shoaib's report that he's already talked about really highlights some of the challenges and the benefits that real life work experience can give some of our most vulnerable learners. So I agree with the idea. Always with anything, the devil is in the detail, isn't it?
You mentioned that a lot of your pupils are endure really extreme poverty at some stages, and often, if not extreme poverty, then forms of deprivation. How ready are those young people, Matt, for the world of work at 16? How capable would they be to do a week's work at Amazon, say, depending on what the job was?
So, I mean, our child poverty has doubled in the last 10 years. It's gone from 33% to 66%. But when you talk about young people, I think they get a really bad deal. And I think young people are incredible. And I think it's an incredibly optimistic job. So absolutely, they are ready. When they're given the chance, when they're given the space, when they're given the time and the commitment, and it's properly prepared for them. Throwing anybody into a situation which they're not prepared for is inevitably going to fail. But when you build it in and you make sure that there are opportunities for them, you teach them about interview skills, you look at CV building, you look at relationship building and oracy and how they communicate, and all of those things look like, especially with the most disadvantaged and vulnerable, they are absolutely ready and capable and willing to do those roles.
Shoaib, are the jobs actually available for them? Are there actually roles? Are there employers willing to take them on and give them the necessary opportunities?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like, over the past 4 months, as part of the review, Peter Hyman and I have been traveling across the country, and we've spoken to over 400 young people who are NEET. And what became clear in those conversations is that young people are not getting enough meaningful work experience. So it's no surprise that when they're leaving school, 65% of them don't feel like they're prepared for the real world. And it was quite clear to us that not enough young people in the UK specifically had enough work experience in school. When we visited the Netherlands a couple of weeks ago, in stark contrast, almost every young person we spoke to had paid work experience from as early as 14. Do those opportunities exist in the UK? I think that's a really important question that we need to look into. But I think it's also really important, like Matt mentioned, that we remember who this impacts the most. So we prioritise speaking to five key groups of young people who are NEET: young carers, care leavers, young people from low socioeconomic backgrounds, young people with neurodivergence, and young people with low educational attainment. And across all of those groups, we know that they're less likely to access work experience at home, and that creates a real class divide. In our report, we talk about the confidence deficit. So the longer a young person goes without work experience, the harder it becomes for them to kind of enter the workforce. And I think the Amazon CEO talked about the effects on their soft skill, their ability to make eye contact, to speak to customers, and most importantly, I think this is the most important thing, to prove to them, to themselves, that they can do it. I think the key here is that we need to give more opportunities for young people to succeed personally.
Well, exactly. We give them that opportunity, they'll grow in confidence, won't they? Shoaib, it's worth saying that we are hoping to speak to Alan Milburn next week when that review comes out. We look forward to it. It's obviously a hugely important issue. Matt Perry, thank you very much indeed as well to both of you for joining us on a busy day.
It's 9 minutes to nine. Now, the last time today spoke to Maggie O'Farrell, it was very glam. She was waiting for a limousine after the Oscar ceremony in March. The acclaimed author was reaching the end of a whirlwind of award success for the film adaptation of her novel Hamnet. Now she's publishing a new novel, Land, inspired by the story of her great-great-grandfather, a mapmaker for the British government in Ireland soon after the Great Famine of the mid-19th century. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, went to meet the writer at her home in Edinburgh.
I'm excited about this, Maggie. I feel really bad. I feel like I'm feeling really ungrateful now. Well,
Maggie O'Farrell is taking me through a locked door into the basement where, for now, she's keeping her new awards.
This is the BAFTA, and that's the Golden Globe. It's really
heavy. How heavy is it?
Somebody handed it to me on stage, and I really nearly dropped it on Steven Spielberg's foot. Can you imagine?
And the BAFTA goes to Hamnet.
She's now in the Hollywood Major League because of her role adapting her novel Hamnet for the big screen.
You touched me, what did you see?
I saw a landscape.
The film's taken more than $100 million worldwide, winning not just BAFTAs and Golden Globes, but a Best Actress Oscar for its star, Jessie Buckley.
It sort of feels like something that I dreamt.
Her sweeping new novel, Land, has already been picked up by Hamnet's film producer. The book's inspired by her great-great-grandfather and his son.
So tell me what this is. So this is a hand-drawn map, which is dated, you can just see here, 1885. And this is drawn by, in the book he's called Liam. So this is my great-grandfather.
She's brought out this family heirloom to point out a tiny painted portrait of her great-great-grandfather standing beside a British soldier.
I can recognise him from the one photo we have of him.
The novel is centred around the story of an Irish mapmaker, like her great-great-grandfather, who worked for the British Army in Ireland soon after the Great Hunger in the middle of the 19th century, when more than a million people died and around 2 million emigrated.
They were doing the second version of the map of Ireland because this huge cataclysm had swept through the country. Whole villages had been wiped out, estates were redrawn, and so many people had been evicted. So it was necessary to do those revisions. But I couldn't really get my head around what it must have been like doing that work, being someone who'd lived through it.
And how much of that past do you think is still unresolved when it comes to Britain's role in it?
Obviously, the famine has very, very complicated and multiple factors. There is this natural element to it, the bacterium that affected the potatoes. And then there are the political, socioeconomic circumstances of the British colonial rule. There's also the way that the British government dealt with it and their attitude to it.
OK, well, this is exciting because it says Land Research Notes.
This is kind of where it began. So you can see here, a novel about emigration.
Maggie O'Farrell's family moved from Northern Ireland to Britain in the 1970s when she was a child.
It was not easy, actually, to be Irish in Britain at that time. And the kind of thin end of the wedge was lots of Irish jokes, and the other end of the wedge was teachers looking me in the face as a child and saying, "Is your dad in the IRA?"
Your book is focused on Ireland, but feels very timely with all the border disputes around the world. And I wondered whether you felt that that prejudice that you faced has actually transferred to other people, whether that is Jews in Britain and what they're going through now, or indeed Muslims or whoever.
Yeah, I mean, I think the rise of racism is really, really concerning for everybody, not just Jews, not just Muslims, everybody, I think, and everyone who can be considered by some people to be an other. So this is my commute to work.
OK, yes, walk across a lawn full of daisies.
We're heading to the glass-walled studio in her garden where she writes.
Are you going to write the screenplay for Land, do you think?
I think I want to, yeah. I think I just find it hard to let it go because it's so personal.
So 10th novel is Land. Are you already working on the 11th?
I do have a superstition talking about things that I haven't finished yet. Just because I think if I talk about it, then it'll kind of somehow drain me of the urge to do it. So I have started something that's quite tentative, and it's a very young shoot. But yeah, I've got something that I'm thinking about.
I want to know what it is. That's author Maggie O'Farrell, and she was speaking to our culture editor, Katie Razzle.
5 to 9, it's Friday, the sun's out, it's about to get much hotter, so we're going to end the morning and the week with a very hard-hitting discussion about fairground rides, because a new ride has been launched for this bank holiday weekend at Blackpool's Pleasure Beach Resort. It's called Avictus, and it's the tallest of its kind in the UK. It's 138 feet tall, and this is what some of the first riders had to say about it. Well, that's the sound of people on roller coasters, isn't it?
That would not be for me. No way.
No, you're not a roller coaster fan?
Nope.
Why?
The roller coaster of news and life is enough for me. Thank you.
I set that up for you very nicely, didn't I? Andy Hine is the chairman of the Roller Coaster Club of Great Britain and joins us now. Andy, good morning.
Good morning.
So you've got about 3 minutes to convince my friend and esteemed colleague, Katia Adler, that roller coasters are actually fun and that it's not a weird thing for humans to do to terrify ourselves. What's the appeal? We'll get into this specific one in a second, but what's the appeal of spending a life on a roller coaster, as you have done, Andy?
Well, of course, looking at the roller coaster, it looks far worse than it ever is when you ride it. And the ride might only last a minute and a half or so, but the memory lasts an absolute lifetime.
You say it's far worse when you look at it. Is that actually true, Andy?
I mean, your brain thinks what might happen, but when you're on it, it's not what does happen. It's the same as if you ride with your eyes closed. Your brain starts thinking what might be going on, and it makes it far worse than the ride really is. So that's why you should always keep your eyes open and just sit back and enjoy it.
Okay, so this is actually, I didn't see this happening, but this is actually extremely useful life advice of the kind you often hear on podcasts, which Katia is listening very closely to. So you would say, Andy, for people, and there are lots of them, perhaps even millions, who think roller coasters are not for them, that they should overcome their fear because there's actually, A, roller coasters are intrinsically fun, and B, there's actually something really psychologically and morally worthwhile in trying to keep your eyes open and go through that fear to try and get to a happier place.
Definitely. And also when you're riding it, the endorphins in your brain, it promotes those and gets a great feeling going. So at the end of the ride, you either think, oh no, never again, or as most people do, you think, actually, that wasn't so bad. I want to have another go.
Are you convinced, Katia? No.
I don't want to be impolite on this Friday morning.
But not entirely. Okay,
feel Andy, the fear and do it anyway, but not on a roller coaster.
Tell us about this new one in Blackpool, Andy, because it does sound like a mega revelation in roller coaster universe.
Yeah, technically, because it's not a roller coaster, it's a spinning ride. It's a giant pendulum swing, but the seating is the gondola that you sit in rotates as it swings.
No.
And it goes so high, 137 to 136 feet above the Pleasure Beach. So if you're keeping your eyes open, like I say, you get some great views of the Pleasure Beach if the gondola's that way at the time. If it's the other way, you get some great views down the promenade.
It's not one of those where as you get to 138 feet above the above the surface of the earth, you're kind of literally facing downwards.
It depends which way you're seated on the gondola, because there's people sitting all around it. So you could be facing the sky, you could be facing the ground. But if you're facing the sky, extra bonus, as it comes back down, you get a bit of weightlessness in your stomach as well. So you feel like you're floating down.
Andy, I'll say this for you. I hope you have a